think they must have popped by for something.
Popped by? Swarmed by, more like! There's a multitude out there!
They started following me yesterday.
Well, they can stop following you right now! Now stop following my son! You ought to be ashamed of yourselves!
The Messiah! The Messiah! Show us the Messiah!
Look who?
The Messiah!
There's no Messiah in here. There's a mess, all right, but no Messiah. Now go away!
Ryan! Ryan!
Right, my lad, what have you been up to?
Nothing, Mum.
Come on, out with it!
Well, they think I'm the Messiah, Mum.
What have you been telling them?
Nothing, I only...
You're only making it worse for yourself.
Look, I can explain.
Now, you listen here.
He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. Now go away.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 13th of May 2022, live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psychological warfare propaganda. And what about the medical misinformation? Tens of thousands of Brits having died unnecessarily. Well, is that because they weren't treated for COVID properly? Or potentially of vaccine injuries? And we've got a story from a BBC presenter, a horrific story about her and her friends have been injured by the vaccines. Transmitter and printing press owners are hell-bent on turning society into a hostile environment for readers, listeners and viewers. And why is that? Well, what about going to Mark Zuckerberg's metaverse instead? That's where we're all being herded. As the fascist cult Nazis our grandparents thought they defeated in 1945 arrogantly strut up and down Whitehall, we're talking here about people like Tony Blair, who should be in jail. Instead, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, Bristol Labour councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles. In part one, we'll be looking at Levellers Day, that is next Saturday in Burford in Oxfordshire, a celebration of the pro-democratic forces, anti-Cromwell, but within the army, that is to say the Puritan army. Well, it wasn't, these people, they weren't Puritans, they were Levellers. That's next Saturday in Burford, so we'll be taking a look at that. Voters defeat the Bristol Mafia, as they're called, that is to say the merchant venturers, who've been quite favourable towards this idea of having a mayor in the local business community. And we'll be looking at some of the people who have been dismayed that Bristol last week voted against having a mayor and for the old committee system. And that's actually Joanne Booth, the blogger and Twitterer, has pulled together an interesting look at who has been getting sad because the mayor is no longer going to be with us in 2 years' time. Also, today we'll be looking at revisiting another interview with Dr. Mark Jones, looking at theft and murder in UK care homes. This is the ongoing theme of probate fraud and dementia fraud, the idea of getting people's property off them when they're vulnerable and in care, or even in hospital. Also, Dr. Chris Busby, interviewed him this week about the micro-reactors being planned for the UK. This is the great new nuclear horizon that Boris Johnson has announced a few weeks ago, and the idea of these mini-reactors. Well, actually, it turns out they're just the same reactors as they've been building for years for the submarines. They just want to build them and stick them in neighbourhoods. But he thinks there's a complete failure of the radiation risk model, and he explains why. He's just brought out a peer-reviewed paper, and he talks to us from Latvia. He also talks, of course, because he's over in that part of the world, a bit about Ukraine. Robert Hansen, our Hong Kong correspondent, is back in the UK from Hong Kong. We'll be hearing from him about why 20,000 people a week are leaving Hong Kong, many of whom are coming here. And in part two, Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Ahlek shot by the Israelis this week. Just shot, quite clearly targeted, deliberately targeted. Just another voice of the Palestinians shot dead by Israel. And Sri Lanka, Pakistan and now Cuba too. Are these terrorist massacres and regime change? The All these three countries voted against Russian sanctions in the United Nations, and now terrible things are happening in their country. Prime ministers being toppled and bombs going off. Martin and I would be discussing that in part two. And has Russia already won the economic war? Carol von Wolferen, he talks to Catherine Austin Fitz, and we have a clip from that this week. Plus, a Friday the 13th special, especially for you. It's October 1307 when the French king, Philip the Fair, had the Knights Templar arrested. The Vatican had warned them, though, of course, and much of their wealth they'd sailed off from La Rochelle, the Templar port in the south west of France, up to Edinburgh. And the Templars were on the run, hence the lodges for safe stays overnight and the Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Anyway, the Knights Templar were exposed as a satanic cult, and so Friday the 13th is actually a good day, and the number is 13 is a thoroughly good omen. I'll be explaining more about that tonight with a look at the 1981 to 1982 P2 scandal in Italy, plus the connection between the Nazi massacres of the Jews and the coming war between Israel and Iran, which we can hopefully avert. But anyway, who is it that's set himself up to emerge as the great peace broker, a silver-tongued version of the prototype Adolf Hitler, a man-god, a so-called saviour, a messiah, who has helped the war start the war in the first place and then arrives as the great peacemaker? Joining us is Fabian Breckles from St. George Troopers Hill. Fabian, I wonder if you can start by just telling us what's happened to St. George Labour Club. I was driving past it the other day. It's one of those great places that people from the left used to get together, get a cheap pint, and it all seems to be wrapped up. It seems to be shut now.
I think it's still trading. What we've found over recent years is that they seem to be more interested in Skittles teams and darts teams than they are in politics. To the point that we'd be booking meetings, the St. George, you know, branch party would be meeting in there, and we'd get a freezing cold room. One case they hadn't even bothered cleaning up from whatever they had in there before, and we just got, you know, I mean, last social we had, we were down the Red Lion in.
Well, this is a pity, isn't it?
In Whitehall Road, that was much more fun.
It used to be a terrific place, though. It was a place where a lot of people in the local community would gather. It wasn't necessarily a centre for politics, but it was a place to get a cheap pint and to chit-chat with socialist-minded neighbours.
Yeah, and it would be nice if we went back to that.
So is it the pandemic that's caused this? Is it as simple as that?
No. There's been it's not been that, you know, political or that bothered about party politics for some years now. I mean, it would be nice if... the building's actually owned by the Labour Party, but it would be nice if we could make it a bit more friendly and...
Is it open or not? I'm not sure. Last time I looked past it, it went past
it
there.
It opens about 7-ish, yeah. But the entrance is down the side. Okay. What has changed is the front lounge... There was a sort of another bar in the front. That and the room behind it have been knocked together and into a big but rather bare space, which isn't used very much. Most of the activities in the main bar, which is an awful lot nicer.
So it's only in the evenings, most evenings during the week, is it?
I think so, yeah.
Thank goodness for that. I walked past, I thought, oh, that's it. You know, nothing going on. Well, anyway, come on, Labour Party. Get somebody who's a bit of an entrepreneurial landlord in or whatever, and I'm sure the place would take off back to its old liveliness. One of the first items I wanted to look at is this Levellers Day next weekend. This is up in Burford in Oxfordshire. It's about an hour's drive, hour and a quarter hip from Bristol. Mm-hmm. But this is, maybe Martin, you can start on this. The Levellers, the fact that we've got such a thing as a Levellers Day is a bit of a minor miracle, really, that the left have managed to get themselves organised. I think it was the communists in Oxford, originally around about the 1960s or 70s, that decided we're going to have a small celebration. The nice thing about it is all day is free. There's speeches, stalls, music, all sorts of stuff. But just give us your take on who the Levellers were. They were a movement within the army, weren't they? Cromwell's army in the English Civil War in the 17th century.
Well, it's held in Burford because that's where the New Model Army was encamped, refusing to go to Ireland. And they elected what they called agitators, which is where we get the term agitator from. It's two for each unit. And they formed a sort of soldiers' council.
Well, they were actually representatives of the soldiers on the army council.
They were elected by the soldiers. Some of them were officers, some of them were ordinary soldiers, but the council was democratically elected by the army. The levellers themselves weren't just in the army. They'd been agitating within the major cities, because by this stage the parliamentary forces had won the civil war, and the issue was, you know, what was going to be the settlement.
I think if you look at the background of it, the Civil War is a fascinating period. A lot of people were fed up with the king, quite rightly, for all sorts of reasons. But as Cromwell's mission to take over and become basically a military dictator slowly moved forwards, particularly during the years of 1648, 1649, as most of the fighting had finished, more and more people started to think, well, it looks to me as if what Cromwell's doing is worse than the king, Martin.
Well, by that, Cromwell at this stage hadn't fulfilled all of that. He was still just an army general. But
well, it's 1649 was the birth of business.
Yes, I know, but by that stage, don't forget, he hadn't become a military dictator at that stage. He was just an army general. And a very senior one, you know, obviously a very powerful guy.
But he kind of was, wasn't he? Because the king had been executed earlier that year.
Yeah, but in theory, Parliament had taken over as a committee, you know. There wasn't an elected mayor. There was still a rebellion going on in Ireland, partly by royalists against the new regime, and the level of position, William Wallin, who was one of their main propagandist spokesperson, who was not a soldier.
Well,
I
don't want to call him a propagandist. I think he was just a writer.
He was an activist. Yeah. He was an activist, and he basically argued that we could settle the Irish question by peaceful negotiation with the Irish, and that what we really needed in Britain was a one-man, one-vote election, which is the first time that that demand had ever been made in history.
Wow.
Which is why it's such an important demand. And the soldiers elected their leaders to say two things. A, we're not going to Ireland. You need to negotiate with them.
Oh, that's right. The soldiers actually marched away from their officers, didn't they? They said, well, we're actually not going to be under control of
you guys
anymore.
Well, they didn't want to be sent to Ireland either.
No.
I mean, they'd won the Civil War in order to get what they wanted.
When they did go to Ireland, when Cromwell's people did go to Ireland, they committed some quite appalling atrocities.
That's right, and that's exactly why they didn't want to go.
And also, the other thing is the soldiers hadn't been paid.
That's another matter, yes. All of these grievances are built
up. What Cromwell was basically saying to the soldiers at Burford was, look, we will pay you one day, but you're going to have to go and fight in Ireland first.
Yeah, I mean...
And they didn't believe him.
Well,
and
yeah.
Not only that, they didn't want to go and fight
They didn't want to go. They also had their own demands. And so there was something called the Agreement of the People, which they all wore in their hats, which was a printed pamphlet, which was their demands. And the demand was... for one person, one vote. And I think this was after the Putney debates where these demands had started to circulate. Because when the parliamentary army took over, there was a big debate in Putney Church, which was famous. But at Burford Church, the army rebelled. Cromwell came down there, rounded up the ringleaders and executed them. So they were all shot dead.
Yeah, they were shot outside the parish church.
Yes, and if you go to the church today, there are still holes in the wall where these guys were shot. Were executed. The rest of them were told, you are now under martial law and you're all going to Ireland, and off they went. And when they got to Ireland, of course, they repressed the local population and created lots of antagonism, which we're still dealing with all these hundreds of years later.
Yeah.
If they'd done that and said, let's negotiate with them, then a whole lot of mess would have been avoided. But that's not what happened. And of course, eventually...
British history is full of that, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stuff where we should have negotiated, you know, it's like, you know... And we're still paying for it now. And
yes.
Other people are still paying for it now.
That's right, because history doesn't, you know, it just keeps on coming back until you resolve the things.
Well,
that
I'm just looking at the lineup. There's all sorts of music. Tiller the Stockbroker, bless him, is there. So it's Siobhan Endine. She's the United National Officer for Equalities. That doesn't sound very exciting. Shami Chakrabarty. From the House of Lords, that's a little bit more interesting. Chantelle Lunt from Merseyside, Kill the Bill. So they're obviously looking at this whole move against the Travellers that the Tories are doing at the moment. And also Leeds East Labour MP Richard Burgeon all speaking there. That's next Saturday at Burford in Oxfordshire. Not all that easy to get to by public transport. I think you have to get a train to one of the stations near Oxford. But anyhow, so I'll see what I can do. If I can get there down there next Saturday, after next week's show, then I'll see if I can do some recording and Because I just like to pick up on these fascinating bits of history and these heroic levellers, really. They were locked up in the church. They were imprisoned in the church, weren't they, by Cromwell? Rounded them up in the middle of the night and said, well, look, if you think you're not going to Ireland because you haven't been paid, think again. I think, do you know what I think? I think you're mutineers and I think you're going to have to be shot.
That's right. And of course, that demand for one person, one vote wasn't fulfilled for quite a long time, but it was inspirational to the American rebels in the 1770s. So, these things continue to resonate even today.
Do you like dressing up, Fabian? If you do, in Civil War costume, no one will mind in Burford next Saturday.
Well, I think they have some people.
Really my sort of thing.
They sometimes have Morris dancers and things of that sort.
Well, they have people dressed in Civil War, a lot of people dressed in. In fact, they have sometimes... You know, these
they'll have reenactment societies.
The reenactment that society will turn up in their gear.
And they'll have all their gear,
Which is rather nice, actually. Anyway, the main reason you're here, though, Fabian, is to talk about the referendum last week. What did you make of the run-up to it? How did you vote? And what do you think of the result?
Okay, so after the last election, you know, we had a much smaller Labour group. But
this is last year,
after last year's 21 election, we ended up with a much smaller Labour group. But we really gelled, and relations between the mayor and this group have got a lot better than there were. I mean, there were some you know, malcontents in the
They left.
But... Yeah, it's
some would say we're bullied out, but anyway, that was maybe what they would say. But anyhow,
I can only comment on what I actually saw or have evidence for. I can't really comment.
Well, I'm just commenting on stuff that's been in the local paper and etc. Joe Sargent, etc. Anyway, you've got a bit of a better group. What was the Labour group's position when it came to, because it was the Lib Dems that got this through by the jank. So what was the general attitude in the Labour group about whether or not to allow councillors to vote freely and speak freely about whether to keep the mayor or not? When you've got a Labour mayor, it's a bit awkward, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, it works. It's, you know, OK, it's had some teething troubles and, you know, but, you know, and certainly with Ferguson, there were some, you know, some teething troubles and, you know, And the legislation doesn't define how the relationship between the mayor and the councillors should operate. That's not in the legislation at all, which it should be. But, you know, we were getting stuff done. Houses are being built, and there is stability. Even though there is no overall control on the council, there is a clear leader, which government know who to go to, and whether hopefully there'll be a change of government to 24 or sooner, but the government know who to go to as who's in charge. The metro mayor knows who to deal, you know, go to, because things like, you know, the transport, sorting out the rapid transit in the wider Bristol area. You need to know who's in charge in Bristol.
You need to know which mayor to go to, don't you? This is the trouble. It's quite easy for government or even us, lowly population out here, to go to the wrong mayor. We approach the wrong person because it's a little bit unclear as to what their...
A lot of that could easily be explained a bit more, I'm sure. But, you know, I mean, it's a bit late now. Yeah. I mean, what basically happened at that full council meeting when this referendum vote went through, and it's cost the city about £600,000 plus, and only 29% of the voters actually voted. So, you know, so it's been sort of foisted on. But basically, the Lib Dems and the Tories, even though... Tory policy nationally is to support mayors. The Lib Dems and the Tories in Bristol both believed that they were never going to win a Bristol mayoral referendum or mayoral election. Therefore, they wanted to get rid of it because it blocked them. It kept them in opposition, even though the numbers they've got, they're not in charge anyway. But, I mean, the Greens were split because obviously Sandy Hall Rutherford, who was the Green candidate last time and was obviously hoping to be the Green candidate in 24, he was still supportive of the mayoral system, but the Green group on the council were voted for and supported the referendum to scrap it and replace it with the committee system. The downside with the committee system is the time it will take to get things done. And if you've got no overall control, got, you know, if a party's got an absolute majority, they're in for 4 years. That solves the problem. Or if you've got a stable coalition, you know, two or three parties agree they're going to work together for the term, you know, for the term of office, and they're going to get, you know, things done, and that's fine. That can work in a lot of cities where there's no overall
control. But if there's no overall control, things can go slowly. Anyway, which way do you vote? You sound to me like you're more pro-mayor.
I voted to keep the mayor because, for me, it has really started to deliver. We've got houses built at a rate that wouldn't have happened before. I mean, you also look at, you know...
Well, that might be partly down to Paul Smith, mightn't it? Who was in charge of housing most of the time.
It was started by Paul, certainly. It was started by Paul, and it's continued. But also, it's, you know, Marvin's put the city on an international stage. You know,
well, hang on,
a lot of things like...
On. We've always been on an international... Let me say, Bristol's always been a bit of an international city.
Not politically. Culturally, yes. Bristol music scene and things like that. Culturally, yes, we have.
Oh, getting his Parliament of Mayors to come to Bristol from other parts of the world and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and also...
That's quite expensive, isn't it? I don't know if it's more or less expensive than
Picked up the bill...
referendum.
They picked up the bill rather than us, as my understanding. I mean, but the thing is, it was, you know, it was a success. We had a place at the table talking about climate change, migration, because obviously with climate change, more and more people are going to migrate to cities, and therefore city leaders need to be discussing, well, okay, if we're going to have this increased migration out of places that become uninhabitable because of climate change into our cities, how are we going to manage that? How are we going to house them?
Or bombed by us in a war, you know, that's another one. But anyway, look, some of the main reasons that people have said that the committee system is better, Fabian, you know, is a really, really simple one, which is that you get much greater spread of experience, opinion, involved in making decisions. If you just get one person, it's quite easy for big business to, you know, lobby them, control them, and that's what happens, of course, in central government too. So it's quite nice to have a local,
Whatever system you have, it's very easy for those with a lot of social capital, those who know how to lobby and, you know, and make their views heard. It's very easy for them to get heard. The issue is the communities that don't have those connections, are out on the margins, out on the edges, don't feel anyone's listening, don't know how to make those connections. Those, you know, it's the question is, how do you bring those people in?
But so, yeah, the people who, and we'll get on to Jo Booth now, because she put out a great tweet last weekend, which was all about the people who were supporting Marvin and the mayor system, as you have been, and the people who were kind of tweeting their disapproval of the result, saying, "Oh, we think this is a very sad result." And this is a little bit revealing. Well, it's very revealing in that what you're seeing here is mostly that big business, the local big business community, you know, are disappointed with this referendum result, which implies, doesn't it, that the whole mayor system is designed and set up for big finance people to just be able to phone up the mayor and get their way. For example, Bristol Airport is one of them. The boss of Bristol Airport, James Cox, he's one of the people who's saying, "Oh, I don't think this is very sad." And she goes on a whole list of them. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page. There's a whole thread at thisweek.org.uk. The Centre for Cities, which Marvin Rees has been involved in, she says, they also approved of the setting up of the City Funds, the organisation that lends money. The one said, don't give too many projects like feeding children because that provides a low rate of return. You know, so things like
this. Actually, we did a lot, you know, about feeding, you know, children over school holidays and stuff when, you know, when it came clear that the government was going to do anything, we found ways of keeping people fed. So, and that's, you know, with the mail system. So we did address basics like that. We have maintained 100% council tax reduction for the poorest families in the city. So no other city, no other core city's done that.
Why is it that Bristol's had this almost like dictatorial, all-powerful mayor, whereas other cities like London, Manchester, Birmingham, they have mayors which are more like figureheads? I mean, they're kind of the guy that goes on TV.
There was problems with Tower Hamlets. I know there was problems with Tower Hamlets, and he's got back in again. He's not Labour, thankfully. But
it's a different system, isn't it, to other cities in Britain? It's anachronistic, as Gary Hopkins was saying last week.
Well, parts of London have mayors, as well as the sort of London mayor, which is effectively a metro mayor, which is, you know, the one that everyone's heard of, everyone knows about. Say with Andy Burnham in Manchester, Sadiq Khan, you know, in London is basically the mayor of the whole of London rather than of any council within it. And same goes for Andy Burnham. He's the mayor of the whole of Greater Manchester. And obviously, Dan Norris is the mayor for the West of England Combined Authority, which is all of the Greater Bristol area. And obviously, if North Somerset comes in at some point, that'll change the dynamic.
Well, it certainly will. Yeah. Anyway, let's have a listen to Marvin Rees now, the mayor, giving his reaction at the end of last week to the scrapping of his role. Has he got a political future after this? I mean, it's like the whole, he has sort of, the vote is basically now saying, well, we don't want you. It means the main reason.
He got re-elected.
Yeah, but he got re-elected mainly because he wasn't a Tory, didn't he?
No, he got re-elected on his track record. He got re-elected because he did a decent job. I mean, you know, we had one mayor, the first mayor came in who was independent. He got kicked out after one term. Marvin got re-elected. You know, there was a choice. There were strong candidates alongside him, and he got re-elected on his record.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees now talking to, and also the leader of the Scrap the Mayor campaign for the Lib Dems, Mary Page, looking at the result this time last week.
I've got concerns about the committee system. I've been very clear about those concerns. I think it's a shame for the city, but having said that, I really hope I'm wrong. And I hope that over the coming years, those who have advocated for the committee system can put a model on the table of leadership that is fantastic for Bristol. It's not focused on winning political points in the chamber, it's focused on getting outcomes for the people of Bristol.
Everybody said they didn't care about the issues of democracy, but they do. And we have the result tonight that we are going to go to the collaborative committee system. And that is working with all politicians and none. That is working with the people of Bristol to get the best results for Bristol. Bristol has a great tradition of being creative and innovative and making change happen. And today we have seen that.
So one of the points of having a focal point is when we're going to search for the billions of pounds of investment we need to decarbonise the economy, for example, or when we're trying to do deals to build houses, major investors want to know who they're dealing with, and they want to know you're going to be there next month, in 6 months' time, in a year's time. They want that consistency because that solidity supports inward investment. You think of our bid for China 4 in Bristol. You know, I was the mayor, I was central to that bid. So, you know, our ability to kind of offer that kind of city leadership from the council could diminish.
So Channel 4 comes to Bristol and gets privatised. Anyway,
we've got one of the creative hubs, which is brilliant for the creative sector in the city.
Yeah. Well, that's if anyone really watches Channel 4 much anymore. I mean, it used to be great when it first started. I suppose there are some people that still watch this sort of TV. Martin,
More than listening to this show.
That's probably absolutely true, yes.
Well, a lot more than listening to this show, sorry.
If we were out on Freeview on TV, actually, yeah, with you and I, my ugly mug, we'd probably have less viewers than Channel 4. So more people are listening to Channel 4 than this programme. But that doesn't mean to say it's good to see it privatised or that the content that's in it is actually worth watching 99% of the time.
Well, the thing is, Thatcher set up Channel 4 as a public body but had to find its own funding, which it did through advertising. Mm. And I think the main reason the government wants to privatise it is because one of the strongest critical news outlets has been Channel 4 News. So they want to get rid of that. You know,
I think that's the main motivation.
They want to get rid of, you know...
ITN, isn't it?
Well, ITN... I mean, I must admit, if I'm watching the news late at night, Channel 4 News tends to be on mid-evening when I'm doing other stuff. But if I watch the news late at night, I tend to find that, you know, ITN's pretty bad.
ITV is... But the ITV news is better than the BBC news, I think, much better.
Yeah, I think everyone thinks
anyway,
that.
Anyway, yeah, so... not.
But much. I think that's probably because the BBC is under the cosh of the Conservatives.
Yep, it's the Ministry of Truth, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, biggest news really this week isn't so much local. We'll be going back to another local story in a minute, but is the Queen's speech, because quite momentous, isn't it, to see Prince Charles giving the Queen's speech for the first time?
It is. I think what bugs me sometimes, I mean, you know, is that they just read this bile out, you know, from a government that's doing nothing about the cost of living crisis. They just read all this bile out and they don't, you know, whether it's the Queen or whether it's Prince Charles, somebody should just, you know, get partway through it and say, hang on a minute, this isn't who we are as a country, rip it up and say, start again. Because it's just, you know, we are just being pushed further and further down a divisive, you know, direction. We're being pushed down a, you know, towards more and more authoritarianism, you know, photo ID for elections. It's about stopping poor people from voting because poor people tend not to vote Conservative. So you basically find a wheeze to remove the franchise from them and you can help rig the election. So it's basically attempted election rigging, you know, and getting rid of, you know, the preferential voting system for mayors. Okay, that won't affect us, but the Metro Mayor will, and the Police and Crime Commissioner will. They're doing that because it'll make first past the post is easy for Tories to win because the anti-Tory vote is split. Whereas if you've got a preferential voting system, the anti-Tory vote can pile up.
Well, bit of news today, which wasn't really in the Queen's speech, is Jacob Rees-Mogg denying that cutting 90,000 civil service jobs is a return to austerity. Now, it does seem to me that there's a major move on right now to basically chop up the government. I mean, how can you carry on government with 90,000 civil servants missing?
I don't think you can. I mean, you know, civil servants, I've got a job in the civil service and I keep that completely out of my political role, so I won't say any more than that. But, you know, civil servants do the job of providing the essential public services that people need. They staff the benefit agencies, they staff, you know, provide all kinds of services, you know, passports, driving licenses, you know, loads of public services that we take for granted are all provided by civil servants. And, you know, it's a very typical Tory response to the cost of living crisis. Oh, how do we help the cost of living crisis? Let's deprive 90,000 people of their employment and therefore their income.
I mean, Martin,
does that help anyone?
The main point of this announcement this morning, Rees-Mogg, you know, sort of being allowed out to speak to the press about this, it seems to me it's just an attempt to cut public spending, 90,000 less civil servants. And, of course, the government services that they're providing at the moment aren't necessarily up to scratch anyway.
Well, I think there's a fundamental question here about what's the direction of economic policy. They are basically doing the same thing they always do. If there's a crisis, cut government expenditure. Now, in actual fact, that's idiotic.
Yeah.
That where we are now, there is no case for reducing public expenditure. There isn't. Now, you might want to say, well, in the long run, we want to balance the books, and I might agree with them, in which case you've got to look at the tax system, which has been completely ripped apart over 40 years. Mm. The top rate of tax in the 1950s that everybody wants to go back to was 95%.
I don't know if you remember on this programme, probably about 5-6 years ago, Kevin Cahill saying he was very chuffed one Sunday to see his story be the front page lead on the Sunday Times, saying with the headline, "The rich pay no tax."
It's immoral. I mean, you've got to, you know, from each according to means to each according to need. You know, we need to pay taxes that are in keeping with our income and our wealth. And that means those who are wealthy need to pay more.
What about the oil companies? What about this windfall tax?
The windfall tax should happen. I mean, we should probably be looking at bringing the energy companies back into public ownership. But, yes, the windfall tax should definitely happen.
It may happen because Rishi Sunak is flagging up that he hasn't ruled it out.
We'll be hearing about that in a minute.
So it may be that they're going to snatch that.
Well, we shall see.
We shall see.
We'll have a little listen to Prince Charles pretending to be the Queen. I thought it was quite amusing to see him reverentially staring at this crown on a kind of chair just sitting next to him. It's a crown on its own. So it was almost as if I am the crown today, you know, almost like enviously, you know, so I'd rather like to put that on my head Anyway, yeah. So he's been hanging
one of these
around
days he will.
Waiting for such a long time. But the Queen, apparently not very well at the moment, so she's finding it very difficult to stand up. Maybe that's to do with the vaccine. Who knows? Maybe just her old age.
It's just her age, I'm sure. I mean, well,
we don't know, do we?
She's in her 90s. She's done very well.
But anyway, so her son took over this week, and here is a couple of clips from the... I mean, I wouldn't dare play the whole of the Queen's speech. It's just too boring. But here's the beginning, the middle, and the end.
My lords and members of the House of Commons... Her Majesty's government's priority is to grow and strengthen the economy and help ease the cost of living for families. In these challenging times, Her Majesty's government will play a leading role in defending democracy and freedom across the world, including continuing to support the people of Ukraine.
So, yes, a couple of main points there. Well, first of all... the cost of living.
They're doing nothing about the cost of living. They don't get it. I mean, Rishi Sunak's one of the richest men in the country. He has no idea what normal people, you know, have to go through. I mean, I have been through a period of, you know, when I was a lot younger, unemployment, having to sort of, you know, deal with housing benefit and other benefits and having to sort of act as gopher between the two offices to try and actually get everything, get all the paperwork through. So you know you don't forget those experiences. And you know, he's always been incredibly rich. He's, you know, his wife's a billionaire. He has no idea how ordinary people live
and defending democracy and freedom, Martin, all around the world.
Well, and specifically in Ukraine. Well, I mean, it's they're using the Ukraine crisis, whatever your position on it, and obviously we'll go into that in more detail later in the show, as a, you know, they've grasped at it like a straw, because they're collapsing in the opinion polls before the latest phase of the war. And of course, Johnson went to Kiev to meet Zelensky. And in actual fact, on the back of that, Zelensky stopped negotiating with the Russians. He'd been negotiating, but then Boris Johnson told him not to. And that's where we are now. The British have actually played a rather pernicious role in this whole crisis going back many decades. But Johnson is using the whole crisis as a diversion from his own problems.
Yeah, anything
his own
that's
problems.
Important that's happening at home, he seems to find something very important in the Ukraine crisis. He's got to jet off.
Well, yes, and if you remember years ago when he was the Foreign Secretary, he didn't want to have to vote on whether there was going to be a runway at Heathrow or not, an extra runway. So he found himself in Afghanistan for a very important meeting. So he couldn't go through the lobby.
Well, he hides in a fridge. He hides in a fridge. In the last election, he was the one who wouldn't be,
yes, he wouldn't be
interviewed by Andrew Neil.
Andrew Neil, yeah.
I mean, you know, how do these people get to stand for public office? I mean, you know, the job has requirements, like you accept some responsibility for your decisions. And I must admit, I'm dismayed that Zelensky is listening to Boris Johnson. He's the last politician he should be talking. Advice from.
Well, indeed, I mean, this is the problem. You see, if we're going to discuss Ukraine later, but the Minsk agreements were brokered by the French and the Germans with the Russians Ukrainians.
They were trying to keep
and they were
us keep, out.
They were keeping the British and the Americans out of it, and of course, that's gradually been whittled down.
So basically, Boris Johnson's just basically trying to wheeze his way into it for his own political ends.
Yes, but the British
and
position,
he doesn't actually care about whether he makes the situation better or worse. Well, he just wants to.
All that, yes, he's
here.
He's got his own distractions. Yeah. The fundamental position taken by the Foreign Office, I've got many questions about that. But, I mean, he's obviously grandstanding for his own reasons.
Isn't Boris simply under the orders for the US?
The US think he's in irrelevance as well. I mean, there's that photo at G26 where, you know, Biden was sort of patting him on the back, as in, you know, like, you know, sit down, little boy. Let the grown-ups have the conversations.
Oh, that's
now.
Right.
You're on irrelevance.
That's because they're not in the EU anymore, for example. Anyway, let's move on in
that's
the Queen's
everything
speech.
Else.
Let's move on in the Queen's speech a little bit. Middle section is about policing, law and order, migration.
Her Majesty's government will protect the integrity of the United Kingdom's borders and ensure the safety of its people. Her Majesty's ministers will take action to prevent dangerous and illegal channel crossings and tackle the criminal gangs who profit from facilitating them. Legislation will be introduced to ensure the police have the powers to make the streets safer.
So the police need the powers to make the streets safer, not the numbers necessarily.
It's always cut about 20,000 police, and, you know, criminals have never had it so good. It's, you know, the actual amount of crime solved is plummeted simply because Theresa the police don't have the resources to do it.
Cameron and May cut them, and then Boris apparently is bringing them all back again. Some of them. But anyway, what about this migrant business? The because there are criminal gangs operating to bring people across the channel, aren't there?
Surely the way to deal with the crisis with migrants in Calais is simply to process them in Calais and actually say, OK, is this person legitimate? Have they got genuine reason to come over? And if they have, put them on a give them the appropriate paperwork and put them on a ferry. And if they haven't, they don't get any further. No one goes in a dinghy. That's what we should be doing. We should be processing them. We should also be looking at how the whole... It's a lot harder now we're out of the EU, but had we remained in it, you know, we should have been looking at how, you know, migrants are, you know, dealt with by the whole of the EU, you know, because obviously if they all come into one, into the border, it's like with Ukraine, there's, you know, is it Moldova that's next door that's really, a really small impoverished country? And, you know, there's not, you know, they can only take so many. So Poland's been terrific about that, about, you know, helping Ukrainians. We're starting to take a few. We're the only country in Europe that insisted on visas and paperwork for people who wanted to come in. You know, everyone else was just saying, you know, bringing them in. And, you know, we were just putting obstacles in the way.
Martin, it might sound a silly question, but couldn't the Queen have some sort of scooter to get in there? I mean, she shouldn't have to walk, should she? She's quite disabled.
Look.
She finds it difficult walking. You know, maybe some sort of motorised throne, you know.
Well, I mean, Tony...
This is the 21st century, maybe we need
a constitutional reform and we don't have a queen at all, yeah? Like the Levellers wanted. Let's put that aside for a minute.
I think the first thing we need to sort out constitutionally, we do need a written constitution, is we need to get away from the gerrymandering and vote rigging that the Conservatives are trying to cause. We need electoral reform. I joined the Labour campaign for electoral reform soon after I joined the Labour Party, within weeks. We need, you know, hope it's coming back to conference this year, electoral reform. Unions are now behind it, so we should be able to get it through, make it electoral reform, Labour Party policy. We then should do a deal with the other political parties that are opposed to the Tories to implement electoral reform, so whether there's no overall control or whether there's an absolute majority or whatever for any party. We've all got in the manifesto, we will reform the voting system from first past the post to something where every vote is equal.
Well, one of the points that Prince Charles makes in the Queen's speech, sounds a bit weird to say that, doesn't it? Prince Charles makes this point in the Queen's speech, is defending the Constitution. So
we don't have a written constitution.
But why is he saying that? What is he trying to defend?
Well, he's defending the existing setup, which has him there reading the script.
We will defend our own position, the royals.
Well, I mean...
Well, it's more Boris Johnson and Co. defending their own positions and wanting to just use their power to basically strip the place bare, you know, line their pockets, line their mates' pockets, and take us for fools.
I think, to be fair, he's talking there about keeping Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England all together, rather than allowing them to split off like Northern Ireland might be doing.
Well, anyway,
let's just have a listen.
That's to the government's position, but whether it's the democratic will of the people is another matter, isn't it?
The Joint Finding Agreement says that when there's a majority in favour of United Ireland in the north, then that's what will happen, and that will be respected.
Those Catholics are breeding away, so that's going to happen, isn't it, at some point? Anyway, look, this is the final section, sort of, I suppose you could call it crescendo, although that word doesn't quite seem appropriate for the Queen's speech.
No.
In this year of the Platinum Jubilee, Her Majesty looks forward to the celebrations taking place across the United Kingdom and throughout the Commonwealth, and to the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham this summer. Members of the House of Commons, estimates for the public services will be laid before you. My Lords and members of the House of Commons, other measures will be laid before you. Her Majesty prays that the blessing of Almighty God may rest upon your counsels.
So that's it. Do you think he did a good job?
It is what it is. I mean, my concern more is about the content, what the government's doing, and it's not actually addressing the problems we've got as a country. And I actually think Boris Johnson's behaviour, alienating Scotland, allowing the, we've got a situation with the Northern Ireland Protocol, which, effectively causes a split. The only real way to resolve that is for the whole of the UK to go back into the single market and the customs union. That will solve the problem. It will put Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK on a level playing field, which is what the unionists want, and it will prevent a hard border between the Irish Republic and the six counties, and that's essential if we're to maintain the Good Friday Agreement.
Well, there's going to be nothing going on in Northern Ireland, really, until there's something done about this Northern Ireland Protocol. So before we hear from Martin on this, let's have a listen to the World at One yesterday, where this Professor of European Union Law, Catherine Barnard, was speaking to Edward Sturton.
The UK legal system is dualist, which means that international agreements only take effect once they have been incorporated into UK law, which is the case with the Northern Ireland Protocol and the withdrawal agreement. There was an act of 2020 that did just that. But of course, under domestic law, we have parliamentary sovereignty. So a parliament of today can reverse that act of 2020. And at a domestic level, that is lawful. But at international level, that's where the problems begin. And the EU will say, look, by reversing aspects of the Northern Ireland Protocol, you have breached the withdrawal agreement, and thus you're in breach of international law. And there are remedies in the withdrawal agreement for dealing with that breach.
What sort of remedies?
So the remedies have two prongs. One possibility is that the EU starts the so-called dispute resolution mechanism in the withdrawal agreement itself. And that is about, first of all, political consultation. And after that, if that doesn't work, you go to arbitration. And then if the UK loses there, remedies can be imposed. The other possibility is that the Commission starts so-called enforcement proceedings, and those enforcement proceedings end up before the European Court of Justice. Or they might just say, look, there are powers in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, and that's the agreement that regulates our ongoing relationship with the EU. There are powers in that agreement to either terminate the whole agreement, and that requires 12 months' notice, or to terminate or suspend the trade part of the agreement, that requires 9 months' notice. But do note, in all of these cases, there are quite long run-up periods, and this is intentional with the view to try to get some sort of political resolution to what is a very sensitive issue.
Professor Barnard on the Northern Ireland Protocol.
So, yes, Martin, what do you make of these? It's a bit of it seems like they want to tweak the withdrawal agreement from the EU and get rid of this protocol, but it looks like a bit of a legal minefield.
Well, yeah, it is a legal minefield. But you could say that there's going to be lots of legalistic argument, but the politics underlying it are clearer. If the Tory government, which is a minority government, and obviously has lost a lot of support since it won the election with 43% of the vote, if they decide...
Hang on, you call it a minority government, and that's because not a majority of people didn't vote Conservative. But there are a majority of MPs, so let's just clear
that's
up.
This is the voting system, and I'm talking about the politics of the situation, Tony, not what's legal or illegal. I'm saying this is the reality of the politics of it. There's just been an election in Northern Ireland to the Stormont Assembly, and the majority voted for parties that want to keep the protocol. Sinn Féin and the Alliance particularly. Now, if it was a normal situation in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin and the Alliance could form a government, the Loyalists would become the opposition, and the protocol would be enforced. Now, because of the Good Friday...
But it's almost as if it's fixed, Stormont, to make sure that can't happen.
Well, that's right, and that's deliberate. The Loyalists do have a veto, and they're going to exercise
but
it.
But, I mean, I think it's fair to call them Unionists, not Loyalists.
All right, because
the tables have turned on the Unionists,
okay,
haven't they?
All right. This is the problem for them, is that they're gradually losing the dominant position that they used to have, and it obviously causes them a great anguish. But when they had the balance of power within our ridiculous system during the Theresa May premiership, And they could easily have said to the Tory party, this is what you must do to avoid a border in the Irish Sea or on the island of Ireland. You've got to stay within the single market or the customs union.
Yep.
One or the other, it doesn't matter which. And even after they said, well, we weren't going to do that, there was another possibility put on the table by the EU, which is you've just got to align phytosanitary.
Going over these old decisions, let's look into the future. What's going to happen
well,
now?
Well, what's going to happen now is that the unionists have made it quite clear that they are not going to form an assembly.
Until Christmas, they think, at least.
At least. But what may happen, and there's certainly agitation on the right wing of the Tory party, people like David Frost and Liz Truss, who's the Foreign Secretary. Don't forget there's an internal fight within the Tory party about who's going to replace Boris Johnson when he goes. And it is if not when. And therefore, they've got to win the votes of 200,000 Tory members. Those Tory members are extremist on this policy. And therefore, to win that vote, the people who want to be Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak included, have got to take a hard line about wrecking the protocol, even though the majority in Northern Ireland want the protocol. So we are now going to go to a trade war, possibly, with the EU, on the basis of something that the people in Northern Ireland don't want.
I think actually a better vote on whether the majority actually want the protocol, because they voted for parties for all sorts of reasons, not just the protocol last week, is to have a referendum on United Ireland. That would be much more sensible.
No, because the Good Friday Agreement says, and everybody agreed to it, that you don't have a referendum until there is a clear majority in favour. Having a referendum where one side run by one vote or by a tiny margin, which is what happened in the Brexit referendum, is basically a disaster.
Tiny. It wasn't that tiny, like one vote.
Well, I mean, the point is, most referendums do, in fact, have, in written constitution countries like Switzerland, most referendums do have, actually, a requirement that a certain amount of people participate, that there's a certain majority, and so on.
Yeah, that's exactly what we don't have in referenda rules in this country.
Well, because we don't have any rules at all.
And it's exactly what we do need. It's like the mayoral referendum. There should have been a threshold of so many votes come in.
Absolutely.
If you do it, and it should have been a universal postal ballot, and then you say, okay, we need half the voters in Bristol have to return the ballot by close of play.
I understand all that, Fabian, but you know, you've got an even smaller turnout for the vote to bring in the mayor in the first place back in 2012.
So
you can't just point at that one referendum. If you're going to have a referendum,
I'm saying for all referenda going forward,
people have
the right to abstain.
People have the right to just walk away and abstain if they don't wish.
The fact is, that is
an abstention. It's not a vote against it.
We don't have clear rules about what is. I mean, the only rule we have is that Parliament is sovereign, and who's got the most MPs in the Westminster Parliament.
I think they should have a referendum in Ireland about whether to have it. And if they don't win the referendum, maybe they're going to be like the Scots in another 10 years.
The Good Friday Agreement specifically forbids calling a referendum until there is a clear majority, because otherwise you're going to restart the war. And that's not what anybody wants.
Maybe. And also, thing is, one thing that the unionists seem to be doing, which I think is wrong. It's inevitable, it's only a matter of time that there will be a clear majority in the north of Ireland for a united Ireland. So what the conversation that needs to be happening is, well, okay, how is that going to work for everybody? How is that going to work for those who have a historical unionist, a history of unionism? How is that going to work for, you know, for everybody? How is it going to, you know, what's the new constitution for a new Ireland going to look like? You know, that's the conversation that needs to be happening. And also, although it's been largely written out of it, there is a book I read a while ago, Rebel Prods. It's about Protestants who are actually in Southern Ireland, who are actually involved in the Easter Rising and before.
Well, the founders of the Irish Republican movement, Wolfe Tone and Robert Emmet, were Protestants from Belfast.
There you go.
But of course, that doesn't mean that modern Protestants identify with that. They're entitled to their
unionist
views.
A lot of this is a cultural thing. It's not a religious thing anymore.
A lot of it's cultural.
I lived down there for a year. I know the score.
I saw Gary McMichael, who was the head of the UDA at the time, speak in the TUC in London to a very Republican audience. And he stood up and he made his speech. And then there's a very Republican audience, but somebody stood up and said, what are you going to do when you're the minority in Northern Ireland? Because in 5 years, 15 years'
right,
time...
Yeah.
You're going to be the minority. And he stood up and he gave a very good answer. He said, we in the UDA share that analysis. We know that when that in 5 years, 15 years, 50 years' time, whenever it is, we're going to be the minority. And when that day comes, we want the same respect and respectful treatment as we are offering you today. And that's why the UDA supports this peace agreement. And he got a standing ovation. And, of course, the Republican movement understands very well that the Brighton bomber, Patrick McGee, has said, we are not going to force the unionists into a united island. That's what the agreement says. It's copper-bottomed. That's why they can be confident
that
they're not going
to
be bullied.
Can we just get back to the protocol, both of you, briefly? Is it going to go, and if so, when, Martin?
I think because of the internal struggles within the Conservative Party, it will go. And, of course, the consequences of that will be a trade war with our neighbours.
Fabian?
I think you could be right. I think what worries me is the Conservatives are only interested in themselves. They don't give a damn about Northern Ireland, the people who live there. They don't give a damn about the people who live in the whole of the United Kingdom. They don't give a damn about the consequences of a trade war for British businesses and for our lifestyles or anything. All they care about is themselves.
Yeah,
it's like the whole Brexit referendum was all about
narcissism.
The whole Brexit referendum was all about trying to settle scores within the Conservative Party. It wasn't about giving the British a choice about which direction of travel they wanted. It was all about trying to settle a score, and they thought they could bully the Brexiteers, you know, in the Tory Party by winning a referendum. And they had no idea what to do if the public voted to leave. So when the people voted to leave, Cameron ran away with his tail between his legs because they had absolutely no idea. They went into a referendum with absolutely no idea what happened if the result came through that they didn't want.
Oh dear. They're not used to not getting their own way, are they? Anyway, one of the main pieces of legislation that's been chugging its way through, which wasn't talked about in the Queen's speech, is this Police Crime Courts and Evidence Bill, which is the Conservative Party, Jacob Rees-Mogg and his chums, criminalising travellers and gypsies, which to me smacks a little bit too much of the far right. And so Bristol traveller Rhiannon Craft went up to London a couple of weeks ago and spoke to the number one expert on this law, Mark Willers, QC, to talk about how this Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act is going to affect people like her. The idea that because you can't afford the rent, that you have to buy a vehicle and start driving around, which many, many tens of thousands of people have had to do, and now they're going to be criminalised too by this lovely Tory government. Anyway, over to Rhiannon Craft from Vehicles for Change here in Bristol and the QC, Mark Willers.
An offence can be committed where there is a likelihood of damage, a likelihood of disruption, and a likelihood of distress being caused. And those are very subjective elements. And it's going to be really easy, I think, for a landowner or indeed a police officer to conclude that in an individual camping on private or public land without consent is likely to cause damage, disruption or distress by virtue of them being on the land or potentially by virtue of their conduct. And unfortunately, and what will play into that determination, that decision-making process, is likely to be, using the wording in the Act, prejudices against gypsies and travellers and others who live in vehicles. And I'm afraid that it means that it's very likely, again using the same word from the Act, that the police will use these powers and will use them much more regularly than they use the powers under the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act. And the question you ask is, well, would the court step in and perhaps, having heard the evidence, conclude that there isn't a likelihood that damage, disruption or distress would be likely to be caused. And I think there is every chance that the court would step in if there were ever a trial. But the problem with the Act and these provisions is they are so draconian in terms of the punishment that can be meted out if there is a conviction, with homes being seized and possibly forfeited, and prosecution leading to imprisonment for up to 3 months. That many people, when asked to leave, indeed threatened with arrest, will simply get up and go, whether or not there was any real likelihood that they would cause damage, disruption or distress. So it will have a chilling effect.
Thank you. So it could lead to a lot of displacement.
Exactly. We'll be chasing gypsies and travellers and others living in vehicles from pillar to post, hounding them, really. And I think, unfortunately, that that is part and parcel of the raison d'etre, the reason behind the legislation to hound gypsies and travellers and others off the road.
So that doesn't sound very nice, does it, Fabian? The idea that the British government has now got gypsies and travellers in their sights, targeting them specifically, hounding them, he said there.
Well, you have to remember that gypsies were, and Roma were among the peoples that were targeted and murdered by the Nazis alongside 6 million Jews. So, it's hounding any particular group.
The reason they're being hounded, surely, is because they're not paying any rent or any payments for a mortgage.
Okay, well, if you want to reduce the number of people living in vans, we need more affordable housing. We need to be able so that people who are forced to live in vans because they can't afford anything else can go back to living in a flat or a house.
A lot of people need, are doing that because they don't particularly want to have to claim state benefits for everything, and they don't want to be reliant on state benefits.
Well, the whole state benefit system is very, very complicated, and it's designed to be awkward and demeaning.
Why doesn't the government actually pat them all on the back for saying thank you for saving us all those housing, all that money in housing benefit?
I think they like scapegoats. Sadly, I think the real issue is they want someone. They want. It's all culture war, isn't it? It's about sort of trying to find people that you can brand as other. And turn people on, get people worked up about the other rather than worked up about the fact that, they can't make ends meet. And, they're working, two or three jobs and they still can't, and they're still having to skip meals so they can feed their children. That's what they should be doing.
I think
Bristol
City Council should take the lead in paying gypsies and travellers for living in vehicles and making sure that they've got proper sanitary facilities, proper rubbish facilities, because they're saving so much of our taxpayers' money on council tax. I'm not saying they're likely to do that. They're not. Martin,
we don't have the means to do it. We don't have the cash.
An act now, received the Royal Assent 2 weeks ago, hounding of gypsies.
Well, that's one aspect of it. There's also the other aspects about political protest. So it's a thoroughly authoritarian mishmash put together by Priti Patel, because she, of course, wants to be Prime Minister, and she knows what those 200,000 Conservative voters, i.e. members of the Conservative Party,
she's a child of immigrants and a racist. How does that work?
Well, because in actual fact, life's a bit complicated, and it's not as straightforward as people think.
The appeal, as much as it is to the Conservative Party members, is to the people funding the Tory Party.
In this particular case, the funders are all but very important. That's why we can't change the economic policy, because, of course, we can't increase taxes on the wealthy, and we've got to give tax cuts. We're still running the deficit from the 2008, and Rishi Sunak is promising people tax cuts. You should say to people, there's no chance of tax cuts for the wealthy for the next 50 years. Don't even think about it.
Yeah.
It's a stupid idea.
Anyway, we did have a debate this week over the Queen's speech, so let's have a little listen to a dip into that. We had, first of all, I think it was Boris. Actually, no, Keir Starmer opened. I think he was certainly spoke before Boris did. So let's have a listen to, rather than at Prime Minister's questions, here they are, hammer and tongs, at the debate on the Queen's speech.
This government's failure to grow the economy over a decade, combined with its inertia in the face of spiralling bills, means that we are staring down the barrel of something we haven't seen in decades, a stagflation crisis. Yep, yep. It is a truly shocking legacy of this government. Exactly. It should humble those on the benches opposite who've ignored the red lights on our economy, even whilst wages were frozen for over a decade, and whose complacency is best summed up by a Prime Minister whose response to the crisis was to make fun of those that were worrying about inflation.
Yeah.
A government of the moment would use the great powers that it has to tackle this head on. Bring forward an emergency budget with a windfall tax for oil and gas producers, which would raise billions. The money that could be used to slash the cost of energy bills and help businesses keep their costs down. Even the bosses at BP don't agree when the Prime Minister says it would deter investment. It's a common sense solution. But instead, the government is bereft of leadership. The Chancellor ruling the windfall tax in, the Business Secretary ruling it out, and a Prime Minister who doesn't know what he thinks.
Well, here's the Prime Minister telling Keir Starmer, Leader of the Opposition, what he does think just a few minutes afterwards in the Queen's Speech debate.
We need the legislative firepower to fix the underlying problems in energy supply, in housing, in infrastructure, and in skills, which are driving up costs for families across the country. And this Queen's Speech takes those issues head on. And above all, we're tackling the economic challenges with the best solution of all, and that's an ever-growing number of high-wage, high-skill jobs, Mr. Speaker. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And we drive up employment by creating the right platform for business to invest. Making our streets safer, 20,000 more police, creating a healthier population, 50,000 more nurses, funding the NHS to help them clear the COVID backlogs, and giving the confidence that people know that they will be looked after in old age by fixing social care.
Is social care going to get fixed, do you think?
Not with this lot in charge, no. You look at how during the early stages of COVID, all those thousands of people sent into care homes untested with COVID, thousands and thousands of people died. That's almost certainly corporate manslaughter. You just can't believe anything Boris Johnson says. He doesn't give a damn about this country or the people who live in it. And, you know, the whole business about the trade war, a trade war with the EU simply to try and win the votes of Tory party members, you know, that's almost treason. I mean, what jobs are going to be left after that?
I think her name is Susanna Reid, gave an interview or interviewed Boris just before the local elections last week for Good Morning Britain. Piers Morgan commented on it, which I thought is worth recounting. He said, "I thought Susanna skewered him," talking of Boris, "beautifully, and he just lost his way and lost his mind, as he does so often." So, Martin, it looks as if most of what Boris is saying in that reply to this Queen's Speech thing is bluster. He's basically doing. He's saying, everything's being fixed, in the knowledge that none of it's being fixed.
Well, he's in a fairly difficult position, and he does what he always does, which is just blurt out the first thing that comes into his head about everything's going forward, trust us, you know that we're going to get it fixed. But fundamental questions about the direction of travel of macroeconomic policy are going to come to a head quite soon. Sunak is quite smart, although he's also lacking in understanding. They're going to do the Osborne fallacy, which we saw after 2008, that because we've got to balance the books, we've got to cut the civil service, and this is all deflation added upon the deflation that's going to come Bank of England raises interest rates to reduce supply side
inflation.
There's
another aspect to all of this, isn't there? Which is that as you reduce the size of government, the people that start to take over are the big corporations.
Well, there's an element. For ideological reasons, they want the private sector big and the public sector small. But I'm talking now about the macroeconomics of driving the economy forward. You don't want to be taking demand out of the economy at the moment. It's a silly thing to do. I mean, we used to know this. It was across the political spectrum when I was in my teens and 20s. Everybody knew that you don't do that. It was just like in the textbook, don't do it. But they're doing it, and they've got to convince themselves that it works, even though the only reason why, in the end, the economy began to recover was because they stopped cutting public expenditure. And this is, they just don't get it. And of course, what they're going to do is they're going to do exactly the same as they did before. The Brexit catastrophe, if it happens, will add on top of this. But they're also, the Tory party funders, you mentioned them earlier, they want to see no increases in wealth taxes and the government expenditure cut. And they are the paymasters.
But the thing is, surely if you've got a business, or you need customers, you need people who can buy your service, buy your products, buy your whatever. If you take money out from the bottom and shove it all at the top. You don't have customers. If you don't have customers, you don't have a business.
Well, that's right. And of course, you know, you, in any case, if you try and cut public expenditures, what Osborne tried to do, what happens is the economy starts to go down.
Well,
it looks
what?
As if we're going into recession.
You know, I know.
Oh, and yes. When you go into recession, we are anyway. Yeah,
Martin, a couple
then
of
the
weeks
deficit
ago,
increases.
I'm not trying to stop you saying that. I think you're totally right. But a couple of weeks ago, Alex Cranier described it as a sort of suicide pact in the West. That actually what's happened, but you know, increasing these sanctions on Russia means that it's going to just exacerbate things.
Well, the international environment is dominated by the ideologies of the 1980s. And one of the things that may
Haven't
come...
Haven't they hit a brick wall yet? I mean, surely someone must have
realised. They've been intellectually discredited for decades. But they don't... The problem is that there's Philip... what's his second name? I can't remember now. But anyway, there are two ways of thinking about neoliberal economic philosophy. One is it's intellectual... ricketiness. I mean, it just doesn't stand up. And the other is that even though it doesn't stand up, it carries on being pushed because it's in the interests of certain groups in society. Mm. The kind of people Rishi Sunak went to school with, hanged around with, they yep. all think like this, even yep. though in actual fact my economics tutors when I was at Oxford University in the 1970s would roll their eyes. It's bonkers.
So Boris is saying he'll fix it all, but actually he's going to fix almost none of it. The other aspect I wanted to look at, I mean, one of the major parts of this is energy policy. What to do about, first of all, less oil from Russia, the fact that the Saudis even are starting to, for example, not pick up the phone when Joe Biden calls them, this sort of thing. I mean, we can't guarantee that oil supply is going to carry on. And nuclear is one of the things which is being put forward by Boris as the great new thing that's all going to work. Well, I had a long and fascinating chat with Dr. Chris Busby, who used to live in the West Country. He got basically chased out of Britain. He's an investigative scientist, you might call, writes various papers for scientific magazines about low-level radiation, and he believes that the risk model that we're using for our whether or not our nuclear power stations and even military facilities are safe is wrong, because they're looking at doses of radiation outside the body. They need to be looking at doses of radiation inside the body when you breathe it in, etc. And I asked him, be great if you can comment on this too, Fabian, before you go, is about the use of mini reactors. This is the great new brainchild of Boris, that he wants to get these little Rolls-Royce mini reactors and chuck them around the country, pop them in lots of little places in order to make sure that when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining, we've still got some power.
These mini reactors, which are basically submarine reactors, are very unshielded and they're leaky, and they produce all sorts of radionuclides. They produce much more radioactive contamination than the standard big ones like Hinkley Point. Okay, so they are very, very dangerous. I'm doing a court case in Scotland about one of these things, on behalf of a lady whose husband was killed by one of these things, who got lymphoma. And those people who live on who work on ships that are propelled by these reactors have about a tenfold excess of cancer relative to the normal population. I mean, I wrote a paper about that was published in quite a prestigious journal about 2 years ago, looking at the US Navy personnel who worked on ships that were nuclear powered. Well, those are the same things. Those nuclear power engines for the ships are what Rolls-Royce are producing, and they're going to wheel out into all the communities in order to give them very cheap electricity. I'm not denying that they produce electricity. It's not so cheap, incidentally, and they're certainly not carbon neutral because of the cost of getting rid of all of the nuclear waste at the end of the day, and the cost of mining the uranium in the first place. And incidentally, a lot of the uranium used in nuclear reactors comes from Russia. So with the restrictions on that, the people with nuclear power stations are having a lot of problems fueling their systems. But look, I mean, if you're going to have democracy, then the people have to be able to decide. If they want to have mini nuclear reactors and die of cancer, well, then that's their choice. You know, it's a sort of balance. It's like you say, we'd rather have a nuclear reactor and have a high cancer rate then freeze to death in winter because we can't get gas or whatever it is.
Yeah, but there's been no discussion about this being something which is going to bring in a high cancer rate, Chris, at all.
No, of course there isn't, because they have this risk model that I'm attacking. That's the point. On the basis of the risk model and on the basis of the nonsense that they tell you about reactors, they don't leak at all. There's no way of getting a radiation exposure to a reactor because they're absolutely sealed up and they don't leak. Everything is perfectly safe. And even if you did get a small dose from the reactor, it wouldn't give you any cancer because the risk model tells you that in order to get cancer, you have to basically stand in front of an atom bomb. Like Hiroshima atom bomb 1 kilometer away, so it's an enormous, the whole thing is an enormous theater in which people are fooled by idiots like Monbiot and that other guy, can't remember his name now, who wrote a book about this. The Green Party is fooled. So the trouble is, Green Party are not scientists. You know, when I was in the Green Party, even then, there were no scientists. Nobody questioned the science. They're all very, very clever people, but they are humanities people. They're people who know about history and about sociology and philosophy and all that stuff. But when it comes to numbers, they're no good. And they have to swallow the guff that's given to them by somebody who says he knows about numbers. But Monbiot knows nothing about numbers. Monbiot is just completely ignorant of science. I mean, I've read his books. They're the books of an ignoramus, all right? And I don't trust the man anyway. Mark Linus, that's the other guy. Well, he's another guy. He's not a scientist either. And these people don't – they just sit down, they write a book, and they write more or less what they like, and everybody swallows it.
Well, what do you make of Dr. Chris Busby's his paper is just brought out, which has been published. I'm not sure what journal it's going to be published in, but it is just out. It's called Ionizing Radiation and Cancer Failure of the Risk Model. So he's saying really that there's actually much, much greater risk of cancer. And in the longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, he also explains that if you look at the atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons in the 1950s mainly, that accounts for the massive increase we've seen in cancer since the 1970s and 80s. And so he's really saying that this is a far more dangerous technology than anybody dares to talk about.
Bluntly, if Boris Johnson is advocating something, I'm going to be sceptical. I think, you know, we need to know what the scientists say about what is safe and what isn't. What is clear, I mean, there is a nuclear industry association that will have scientists involved in it who can do numbers and can do things. We do
They're
need
probably
to,
reading we, right. Chris's report right now, okay. Trying to pull it apart.
Right. Let me we do need to decarbonise our energy supply. We do need to decarbonise, period. Renewables are an essential part of that, but we haven't quite got to the point where renewables and battery storage can provide 100%
supply. But is there any
point
in decarbonising if the Chinese aren't going to bother? Sorry to, it's an awkward one,
well,
isn't it? Because
that's
one way of looking at it. The atmosphere doesn't have any borders. So
that's one way of looking at it, but, I mean, eventually this climate change is going to start affecting the Chinese. Now, whether they give a damn when it happens to them.
Well, it certainly is already, isn't it? I mean, you know, Beijing is full of smog. Anyway, Martin, can you just give us your comment on
this? You didn't let me finish what
Sorry,
I was going to say.
Carry on.
I mean, the point I was going to say is that we should be looking at, you know, the seven, there's, you know, unlimited
tidal power
in the Severn. You know, the Tories are banning onshore wind farms. Well, look at the science, look at the geography. You know, if they make sense, put them in. If they don't make sense, don't. You know, they're just coming up with, you know, random things instead of an effective climate change policy.
That's right, Martin. They're calling them mini reactors, not submarine reactors, aren't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, from an economics point of view, nuclear power has never been viable without subsidy. It's just a fact.
Isn't it becoming viable as other forms of energy like oil become more expensive and gas?
It could do, but don't forget the real problem is the waste. They wanted to privatise British nuclear fuels in the 1980s when I was working with the New Economics Foundation, and the City of London at first were licking their chops thinking, oh great, we'll have, loads of money here. And as soon as they looked at the books, they said, nah. Not touching that with a barge pole. And the EDF, which is the, you know, the Electricité de France, the French nationalised industry, which has plenty of nuclear power stations, it's because it's a nationalised industry. They can put loads and loads of money into it over years and years and years. And once you've got a nuclear power station, you might as well run it, because you might, because otherwise you're wasting, you know, the waste isn't going to go away. The problem is with the waste, and you can't get rid of it. And in actual fact, it's the public sector which soaks up dealing with nuclear waste.
Paul Mobbs and I did a little calculation. He does a lot of work on planning applications and things about tidal power in the Bristol Channel, Fabian. Mm-hmm. And we worked out that it would be roughly about a third of the price, or between a third and a half of the price, to generate the same amount of power from the Bristol Channel using these underwater like propeller type things than to build
turbines.
Without any waste afterwards. And actually, there's a whole industry in maintaining them too. So why are they not building these tidal systems?
I have no idea. It's absolutely criminal. All this energy is there waiting to be harnessed, and we're not doing it. And harnessing that kind of energy could be really significant for tackling climate change.
Finally, on Hinkley, Chris Busby is adamant. He says Hinkley will never be finished, never be switched on. He thinks that the whole thing is just a Ponzi scheme in order for the companies that are building it to make a fortune. Is that feasible, Martin?
Well, I mean, people making a fortune out of it, yes. I mean, that's what most things end up being done for, because somebody makes some money at it. But can I just make another point, which is in terms of going forward over the next 2 or 3 years, where we're going to have a huge crisis in energy and other things, this is not going to solve the problem. Even if nuclear power was the answer, and I don't think it is, you're talking 10, 15 years in the future. No hope, no help at all for people who are going to freeze next winter.
One little aside I do want to chuck in on nuclear power. Germany decided to get rid of it, and as a result, they're now digging up and using some of the most polluting coal, you know, close to the surface coal.
Yeah.
And whole villages and towns are being demolished to access it. So they're actually doing something, because they wanted to get rid of nuclear, they're now doing something that's far worse for the environment.
I know, but they would argue, wouldn't they, that their technology now has enabled this getting rid of all the particulates from coal, making it much, much cleaner to do, and stepping it up. In fact, I can remember years ago, even Arthur Scargill, the National Mine Workers Union, saying, oh, we've got the technology to make coal much cleaner in this country. So the idea that coal is gone forever, especially when there's so much of it underneath us, has it gone forever, Martin?
Well, I think there are a number of levels to this, aren't there? There's the global level of trying to change the way we make things and do things. Then there is also the functioning of the existing energy markets, the existence of OPEC Plus, for example, and so on. And that, of course, is actually not really about economics. That's about politics.
I mean, it's a bit like the lockdowns, isn't it? If there's a global economic crash, surely we'll be using less energy.
Well, that's what when the Soviet Union went through the transition crash in the 1990s, that was when carbon emissions drastically reduced. But of course, it was a devastating impact on the ordinary population in Russia, where the death rate, you know, the age of death went down and the death rate went through the roof.
Anyway,
they were having a real stagflation, with everybody being thrown out of work and 1,000% inflation overnight.
Our final item before the break, and we say goodbye to you, Fabian, is about the family sex show in I don't know if you've seen this story in the national papers.
I've read the story.
And so before we discuss that, I thought I'd try and lighten the mood a bit by, there's a comedian, an American comedian called J.P. Sears, who I suppose he's kind of winding up some of the lefties that are kind of very, very, almost extremist, pro-trans, etc., LGBT, by posing this little situation, a kind of sitcom, where he's a teacher introducing kindergarten kids of 5 years old to the whole concept of these different forms of sexuality.
Welcome to your first day of kindergarten class. We're going to have a great year, and together, I think we're going to put the ass back into class. Right, kids? As your teacher, it's my job to guide your growth and development, keep you safe, instill my values into you, teach you how to become a leader, and watch you go to the bathroom. In a little bit, we'll do an assignment where you decide what your gender is, but first, I want to draw.
I don't think that's how it works, because when my baby sister was born, she came out and the doctor said, it's a girl.
Doctors are literally just guessing genders at birth. They don't know what they're talking about. Now, because you're five, you need to understand more about me and my sexuality. Now, this is a drawing of what the coagulated clump of flesh in my crotch looks like. My partner's is the same, only more inverted. Zer's name is Atticus Moonflower Seaman. Currently, Zem's trying to get me pregnant, so we're having very aggressive sex with each other, a lot.
Zem, victim, teacher, Zer, I'm uncomfortable with this conversation.
That's because you're transphobic, so it is very wrong of you to feel uncomfortable while I'm sexualizing you.
What's a pedophile?
Mostly nice people that are unfairly oppressed because they're very misunderstood.
Why do you ask? Because my dad said that's what you are.
Well, tell your birthing person I said thank you for the compliment.
Ooh,
and before I forget, here are permission slips to go on our field trip at the end of the month to Disneyland. Now, if your parents won't sign it, just let me know, and I'll sign it instead, because you are mine now.
That's J.P. Sears. Comedy for some and not for others, but it's a serious point he's lampooning there, which is the idea of naked bodies dancing around in front of five-year-olds. Is it appropriate or not?
Absolutely not appropriate. Five, you need to be learning about healthy relationships and things like that. You need to be, you know, it's potentially child abuse, psychological, you know, and it's completely not appropriate. You need to, you know, when you're little, you need to know, you know, about what's, you know, being nice to somebody, what's being nasty to somebody, what's, you know, consent, you know, what's sort of, you know.
Yeah, good and bad, right and wrong.
Good and bad, right and wrong. Yeah, exactly. You don't really know what to do, you know.
In fact, most kids have got a sort of innate sense, and when they're doing something wrong, they kind of know it almost, don't they? Anyway, Martin, what do you make of the little comic sketch there and this whole idea of being naked in front of five-year-olds in a theatre down at the tobacco factory, which was then cancelled?
Well, I mean, there's the issue of this particular performance at the tobacco factory, which people have taken umbrage at. I don't even know what was in the performance, and we're never going to know now because it didn't take place. But that, you know, you can hear that's an American accent, that's an American cultural meme that we're listening to. The right wing in America have decided
really
that the left wing are all in favour of sex with children.
It doesn't matter whether it's American or not.
Well, no, but we are taking our culture war themes from the United States. It's part
well,
of it's
no,
part
hang on,
of
because this is this the culture war theme actually came from Sonia Poulton, who was the organizer of the protest against this thing in Bristol.
Yes.
I mean, he's looking at that topic. He's an American. He's quite entitled to the similar things are going on in the States.
Yeah.
I think the main problem seems to be the idea of sexualizing 5 year olds.
Well, we can all agree
and it's wrong.
Yes,
we can all agree it's
we
wrong.
We can all agree it's wrong, and in actual fact, that's not what happens in kindergartens at all. I work in a primary school. Nothing like that occurs. I can promise you, nothing.
There you go. So just keep it where it is then.
Well, exactly. What you want for children, children will find out in due course by all of this stuff, and they will have sex education when at appropriate for their age.
Exactly.
We don't want to go back to the days when people got pregnant without even knowing what was going on as teenagers.
No,
it's
you've
ridiculous.
Got to have, I mean, I know. I mean, when I was a teenager, the sex education was a joke. It was literally a biology lesson, and that was about it. Nothing about what was going on in, you know, as, you know, adolescence kicked in and everything went.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were about 12, I think, when we got sex education lessons in secondary school, and it was just a bit embarrassing. But it was, I suppose, there were one or two bits and pieces that we didn't know about, things which were added to the education. It's got to happen, but not really for five-year-olds.
Well,
no,
it's not appropriate for five-year-olds, but in most kindergartens, if to use the American phrase, that doesn't happen at all.
No, but there are, for example, books aimed at those kids of that age, like infant school kids, introducing the whole idea of transsexuality and trying to get forth the idea.
I think it's perfectly okay for quite young children to be aware that there are both homosexual and heterosexual relationships.
Yeah. Well, some
that
people
doesn't mean that doesn't mean that we're going to be spending most of our time talking about that.
Or
we've got times tables to
or
do.
Or taking our kids to the tobacco factory to watch people taking their clothes off. Anyway, that'll do for now.
I'm not a parent, but there's no way I'd have taken any kids of mine to that.
Okay. So thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, who will be back in a minute. Also to Labour councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven, and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. Amen.
My disciples, I stand before you in the name of the one
Thank you.
Prudens Futuri, and that's called in the name of the one.
So that's very difficult to read. Prontadulais. That's ProntadulaiS. Male voice choir with Comrades in Arms. That was recorded in 2006. Before that, Prudens Futuri in the Name of the One from 1995. And before that, The Corrected Creed. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, plunging straight into looking at Ukraine in part two. And I was pretty disgusted, really, with the one of the things I try and do with this show is to identify some of the real big movers and shakers behind the scenes. And somebody popped up on the BBC this week who I think is fascinating to have a listen to, and it'd be really good to get your take on him, Martin. He is an American, Daniel Fried, F-R-E-S, that's his name, Fried, F-R-I-E-D. First of all, we've got an amazing clip just coming up here. And I looked at this and I thought, maybe someone at the BBC has done this deliberately, right? Because as he's talking on the left-hand side of the screen, pictures on the left-hand side of the screen, a tank rolls into the picture and then starts firing directly at the guy's head. It's one of those wonderful things. And you can actually hear in the soundtrack we're about to play, you know, this boom sound, boom. Every time this tank fires, it's about three or four times, it's pointing straight at this American. But anyway, his name is Daniel Fried. He is in charge of sanctions for the United States, or was under Obama, and he's sanctions coordinator. So he's the guy that puts all these sanctions on. And we very rarely hear these people. We very rarely even see them. But anyway, here he is, and I'll put the full version up of the video of the interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as I do in many of the interviews we do here. But have a listen out, especially for the gun going off of the tank, which is in the screen, on the screen next to him, firing at this guy's head. But anyway, this is Daniel Fried talking about Lendlease, this new massive $33 billion for Zelensky from the US.
The Lendlease bill has enormous symbolic significance, and the fact that it passed Congress overwhelmingly, with Republicans and Democrats uniting, is a very good sign for American leadership of this effort to push back on Putin's aggression against Ukraine. Now, the $33 billion is necessary. The Lend-Lease bill provides some streamlining, but it isn't, to be honest, quite the dramatic step forward that the original Lend-Lease bill was in 1941, because we're already able, under the law, to provide the arms to Ukraine. But still, this is a symbolic gesture, and the $33 billion request, that isn't symbolism, that's real money, and it's needed.
And it could be signed into law by Joe Biden on the 9th, which, of course, is symbolic as well, because that coincides with Victory Day in the Great Patriotic War that Putin will be celebrating in Moscow on Red Square. Could it bring about a speedier end to this conflict, do you think, bearing in mind how much weaponry will be going into Ukraine?
The task now for all of us, the UK, US, Europe, is to lean forward to provide the Ukrainians the arms they need to defend themselves and intensify the sanctions on Russia. Do it right now. May 9th, as you suggest, is apt to be an important day symbolically, and maybe not just symbolically if Putin uses the occasion to make some announcements. But we need to make clear to him that he's not going to win this war, and we need to back the Ukrainians. And by the way, it is not fanciful anymore to think of the Ukrainians actually succeeding in blunting the Russian offensive. They've been doing an awfully good job of it. And this is a success which is not inevitable, but it's possible.
Well, I think actually the BBC did an awfully good job of a brilliant pictorial diorama of a main battle tank firing at the head of the guy you just heard there. But anyway, Martin, he's a American ambassador, they call him, but his main job under Obama was coordinating sanctions against Russia and other countries.
Well, I mean, the self-referential nature of this discussion is obvious when, they just say that what they think is happening is happening, even though it's, the facts are contrary.
One thing is happening is this $40 billion is chugging through for Ukraine.
It's not $33 billion, it's been up to $40 billion. I mean, it's only other people's money we're spending. And of course, that money will eventually, most of it, end up in the pockets of weapons manufacturers in this country and the United States.
The news is it's been blocked by Rand Paul in the Senate, the vote for $40 billion aid for Ukraine. On Thursday, Senator Rand Paul, Republican Kentucky, blocked an effort in the Senate to hold a quick vote on the nearly $40 billion aid package for Ukraine that passed in the House of Representatives on Tuesday. He said, "My oath of office is to the US Constitution, not to any foreign nation. No matter how sympathetic the cause, my oath of office is to the national security of the USA."
Yeah, well, Rand Paul has been consistent in his opposition to military spending over many years, and although I don't agree with his economic analysis, I mean, he's very libertarian.
Well, he says we cannot save Ukraine by dooming the US economy.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the other thing is you can't save Ukraine by supplying them with loads and loads of weaponry, which either they can't use or they will use in order to continue the conflict, and they, of course, have, in fact, engaged in human rights abuses themselves. The idea that I'm willing to listen to people saying that we've got evidence of Russian human rights abuses, okay, but we've got overwhelming evidence of Ukrainian human rights abuses going back to 2014 and the Maidan Square massacre, which was carried out by a NATO death squad. We know this because there's already been a court case. I'm quite sure that this guy either doesn't know that, in which case he's a fool, or he does know that, in which case he's a knave.
He's also talking about Putin's aggression. This is a phrase that comes up again and again, isn't
well,
it?
Well, this is by using this kind of language, you preordain what people are supposed to think about what's happening. And I suppose people can say whatever they like. But then, of course, in Russia, the dialogue about this whole crisis is very, very different. They've got a whole different knowledge about what, in actual fact, the Russian population is far more knowledgeable about what goes on in Ukraine than the people in the West. The languages are mutually intelligible, and the Russian public have been following this crisis on the edge of their seats for 8 years.
I mean, we're going to
people in the West have suddenly decided that they think they know all about what's going on there, and in actual fact, their level of basic information about factual stuff about the situation is pitiful.
We're going to be hearing a bit of Putin's May Day speech in a minute, and a bit more from Daniel Fried as well. But what's your take on the way things have been going this week in Ukraine?
Well, I think the most significant thing is that the peace talks between Russia and Ukraine seem to be, you know, running into a complete dead end. And that is because the Ukrainians have been promised that the West is going to help them win, which is absurd. And, of course, we've got Liz Truss promising that they're going to fight on until the whole of the Ukraine has been liberated, which, of course, is an impossible goal. So what the Western deep state is trying to do is set up a permanent war in the Ukraine, which they think will bleed Russia. But in actual fact, on the ground, the Russians are winning. And of course, the economic war against Russia, which no doubt we will come on to, is turning out to be a spectacular own goal by the West.
Well, the Saker, in his article, 2 months of Operation Z. What is the significance of this Z figure? I've seen a few people talk about that. Some saying that in the idea is it's the end for the non-Cyrillic alphabet people. That's us.
Well, I don't know what the reason is. It may well. I mean, I've heard several things said about it. In Russia itself, the symbol of Z has been adopted as showing that you support the government's position on the war. Okay, so it's like a bit like the CND symbol representing people who are opposed to want peace.
So we're in a bizarre situation
for whatever reason, that's what it's come to.
Well, the bizarre situation where the Z thing could be banned, whereas some of the Nazi symbolism used by the Azov is fine.
Well, that's right. And of course, what's happening now is a very strong attempt in the West, I would argue, rather than in Russia, to bamboozle people about the real causes. The ghost of Kiev, which was supposedly a ace fighter pilot who'd shot down 40 Russian planes, and it was pointed out very early on that the Ukrainians were pushing this guy and the idea of this ghost of Kiev pilot, and it was quite obvious from the get go that this was actually from a computer game. But the Ukrainians this week have said, yes, well, we made all that up, but we did it for the good of the country because it rallied morale and it got more support in the West. Now, they've admitted that they made it all up, even though they were pushing it for weeks and weeks and weeks about how fantastic this guy was, made up by Ukrainian intelligence services, and no doubt with advice from helpful intelligence services like ours. And the West seems to be saying, we lie about what's going on in the Ukraine because it's part of the war effort and people have just got to accept that we're going to lie.
Another thing that Alex Craner talks about quite a lot is the absolutely amazing anti-Russia coverage in the Western press. Looking through the newspapers, you see every single story in one aspect or another is anti-Russian. But I saw something this week in the Daily Express which wasn't quite that. A shock poll has revealed that Americans are okay with Ukraine losing the war with Putin's Russia. Americans are okay with letting Ukraine lose the war to Russia. A shocking poll for the Express has revealed. That was in last Saturday's Express. Monthly Democracy Institute Express. Oh, hang on. That's a Democracy Institute Express poll of 1,500 Americans. So this is the Daily Express, along with the Democracy Institute, polling people in the US. Likely voters, who has shown that 43% are okay with Ukraine losing, compared to 41% not okay, while 16% don't care. This comes despite the heroic attempts of Ukraine President Zelensky to garner worldwide support against the Russian invasion.
Well, I think, I mean, the people who don't care could be included in those who don't care, and therefore the majority don't in fact care whether Ukraine wins or not. And I can imagine that lots of ordinary Americans, don't forget they're thousands and thousands of miles away from this.
That's not quite the case, is it? So you've got, I've just spelt the figures out there.
Yeah.
So 43% are okay with Ukraine losing.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine lots of people in the US have got plenty of things to think about, worrying about what's going on in the Ukraine, a place many of them probably can't find on a map.
The media isn't really reflecting public opinion here, I suppose, is the point of all this, is it? We're getting wall-to-wall propaganda, pro-Zelensky, pro-Ukraine, the evil Russians, where actually most people don't care about it.
Well, it depends where you are.
In the US, they don't care.
If we're talking about the US, then that's what we're talking about. I think that people are only going to wake up to what's been going on when the Ukrainians comprehensively lose the war, which I think is going to happen over the summer. And then there'll be some kind of imposed ceasefire. The Russians will just say, right, we're finished now, ceasefire. The Ukrainians won't be in any shape to say, no, we don't want a ceasefire. And then that'll be that. And then what may well happen at that point is people have been whipped up into this frenzy about we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and then they'll face the reality that there's not that even if you wanted to do something, there's not a lot you can do, because the Russians are going to win a war in the Ukraine, just like the US would likely win a war in Mexico.
Well, John Platinum-Goss is a blogger, friend of this show. I've interviewed him a couple of times over the years. His article says that Lieutenant General Trevor Cadio, he believes he's in Azovstal. For the last 3 days, civilians held in the tunnels of the Azovstal industrial complex have been evacuated during ceasefire intervals agreed by Russia for that purpose. Up to now, 182 civilians have been released in these latest evacuations. Russian media outlet RIA Novosti, reports that those wishing to go to Kiev-held territory have been handed over to the Red Cross and representatives of the UN. Equally, civilians wishing to evacuate to Russian territory have also been helped by the Red Cross. But he's talking about who's left. And apparently this, I think he's a Canadian general, NATO general, may be in there. And then he says, and the second title of his this article is, what, another lieutenant general? Some will recall that Western-paid fact-checkers worked tirelessly to dispel information that a US lieutenant general, Roger Cloutier, had been captured in Ukraine. So, I mean, how likely is it that NATO actually is secretly, does have its commanders actually on the ground there? They're not just giving, you know, information which will help the Ukrainians, that they have their military commanders on the ground.
Well, it looks like there may be a British officer who was killed in the attempt to retake Snake Island, which the Russians pulverised this week. And British special forces are definitely in Ukraine, and they have been for the last 8 years. And in many respects, we are already, as a country, at war with Russia in the Ukraine. And the Russians aren't making such a big deal about this in the sense because, you know, they don't want to put themselves in a position where they have to start whacking British generals in Britain.
John's done terrific on his John. It's called johnplatinumgoss.com, his blog. He's done a terrific job on this because he's pointed out that they're saying that this ex-general, he's not really a general anymore, he's an ex-general, he retired and he travelled to Ukraine to help and defend the country from Russia's invasion. He was in charge of Biolab number one, potentially as well. He says if he was no longer a late NATO lieutenant general, simply a mercenary helping out Kiev from the goodness of his heart, why would there be so many attempts to rescue him?
Well, there is a suspicion. I mean, don't forget,
there's a cover, do you think? The idea that, this general's retired and he's just gone over as a mercenary, just out of the goodness of his heart to help Zelensky.
Well, all I'll say about all of these kind of speculations is that they're speculative. We do not know what's actually going on, but what we do know is that NATO intelligence services, special forces, officers have been embedded with the Ukrainian military for the last 8 years. And they've trained them, they've directed them, they're directing the propaganda campaign from, which has been very effective over Western populations, from Kiev. And the Russians are very well aware that they're not just fighting the Ukrainian army or the paramilitary, right-wing paramilitaries, they're also taking on NATO. Which is why, of course, they haven't committed all of their forces, because they fear that there's going to be a follow-on attack, and that they will have to take on the whole of NATO, which of course they will win. I mean, this is the other thing, as Scott Ritter has pointed out, there is no way that NATO could win
it's
a war
like you're
with
saying,
Russia
Martin,
in
it's almost
conditions.
Like you're saying that Russia is coming to our rescue.
Our rescue of who?
Well, of the people, the good people in Ukraine.
Well, I mean, that's
and is in the Donbass, etc.
Well, yeah, well, of course, the Russians.
Whose side you're on? Well, Russia. So Putin is your general riding over the sunset to help you.
Well, what happened was, I mean, you know, the evidence is piling up. Over the last 2 years, up to 100,000 Ukrainian troops have been massed on the border of the breakaway republics. That hasn't been true for over 8 years. There was a ceasefire, and supposedly heavy weapons were supposed to be removed from the front line, and the situation was supposed to be resolved through negotiation. And in the last 2 years, not only have the Ukrainian side refused to negotiate with the advice of the British particularly, but they've also massed their troops and clearly were about to attack. And so in actual fact, they started shelling, massive shelling, of the Donbass breakaway republics about a week and a half before the Russians said, right, we're coming in.
I know all this, but I'm trying to pin you down on, do you think then that Putin is taking on the evil people in London as well as just in Ukraine?
I'm quite sure. Let's not personalise this about Putin. You've got Shoigu, who is the defence minister. You've got Lavrov,
right,
who's the foreign
Russian,
minister.
The Russian army. It's a Russian army taking on the Russian opponents of truth and justice in London and in Washington too.
The Russian state.
By attacking Ukraine.
The Russian state has war gamed this comprehensively over the last 8 years. The decision to intervene in the Ukraine was not taken lightly at all. And I think Putin's speech in Red Square was quite clear about that. He's saying we didn't really want to do any of this. We've been pushed into a corner and that's why we've had to do it. Because these are the reasons. And the Russians spelled out what they were unhappy about, you know, in words of one syllable years ago. And of course the Western powers, Germany and France in particular, agreed that there would have to be a negotiated solution. And we're at war. Okay.
When the Saker talks about Putin and the Russians, I won't say Putin, I'll say the Russians, are not just taking on the Nazis in Ukraine, they're also taking on the Nazis all over the West. Would you agree?
Well, I think the problem with using the word Nazis is, I think this is political rhetoric. We are the deep state in the West.
Right, the supporters of the Ukrainian Nazis.
Yes.
Then.
Yeah, but the deep state in the West also supports Islamic jihadists to try and overthrow the government of Syria. Yeah, they support anybody that will help them fulfil their goals.
Well, we've had quite a lot of other regime changes, haven't we? Pakistan and Sri Lanka too. We'll be talking about those a bit in a minute. But let's go back to Daniel Freed, however you pronounce it, this former Obama sanctions coordinator, Ambassador Daniel Freed, talking about whether these oil sanctions will actually do the job.
You mentioned sanctions. The EU recently discussed the oil sanctions, first of all, before the gas sanctions, which affect so many and of which so many European countries are reliant. But do the oil sanctions go far enough? I mean, you've got exemptions for Slovakia and Hungary, and there's some suggestion that Russia can actually weather the impact of these oil sanctions.
Every new sanction helps. If you ask me whether we should be doing more, the answer is pretty much always going to be yes. But the oil sanctions may not be 100% effective, but every dollar that and every pound, every euro that we take out of Putin's war machine is good. And don't look at the oil sanctions as zero or 100. Think of it as another bite out of Putin's war budget. I'd like to see the EU announce a final deal. And if there's an exception for Hungary, you know, an exemption for a limited period of time, I'll live with that. Policymaking isn't for purists. I want to get the best possible results.
Hungary's going to block this, surely, Martin. The EU is not going to be able to stop all oil imports by the end of the year from Russia.
Well, that will then create a constitutional crisis within the EU. But of course, the Hungarian.
No, it would just be a vote, a veto. They won't have. They won't
well,
do
no, because the EU will override it. Yeah, that's what will happen because NATO has told them what to do and they're going to do it.
The EU is a tool of NATO.
Of course it is. We know that. I mean, and that, you know, the British now, having left the EU, are telling the EU what to do, because they are much more senior in NATO than places like Hungary.
So it almost doesn't matter that Britain has left the EU.
No, because we're going to tell them what to do anyway.
The poor French and Germans, hoping to get rid of all this US influence through Britain, haven't actually managed to achieve anything, because we're still far too powerful through NATO. And once Europe becomes militarised and we've got a war going on, suddenly NATO's in the driving seat, not Brussels anymore.
Well, I mean, Brussels was
actually,
always
that's where NATO
leaf.
Is.
Yes,
that's
yes where it's all in Brussels, yeah. It was actually originally, NATO headquarters was in Paris, but de Gaulle kicked them out. and that's why they had to go to Brussels. What's really interesting about these sanctions is that the ruble is now stronger than it was before the war.
Oh, it's fantastic. Well, we're getting
into
that in a minute as well.
And, of course, in actual fact, the amount of money, the more sanctions they put on Russia for oil and gas, the more the oil and gas price rises internationally. And that, in fact, means that the Russians get more money for selling less oil and gas. And then, in actual fact, they're quid's in.
Anyway, Daniel Freed also talked about this speech, which was made this week at the big Red Square rally by Putin.
You know the region well. You've worked there extensively. What are you expecting Vladimir Putin to say on May the 9th in terms of the special military operation and what is happening there? Will he recognise at all, do you think, and his top military brass that mistakes have been made?
I doubt he'll recognise that mistakes have been made. But he has a dilemma. He needs to be able to announce some kind of victory, and he doesn't have much to report. There's a hysterical quality about Russian official propaganda, which suggests a nervousness because Russians know that this is not going well. What can Putin do? Well, he could proclaim an annexation. He could claim more territory based on what he's already conquered and claim victory based on that. Trouble with that is he may not be able to hold the territory. There was some rumor that he was preparing a declaration of war against Ukraine, a big escalation and mobilization. Maybe. The trouble with that is I'm not sure that calling up people in a mass way, drafting people in big cities, is going to be all that popular. He faces a lot of tough choices. And on May 9th, President Biden is going to have a chance to push back. President Macron, because it's Europe Day, May 9th, will have an opportunity. And you may have a counterpoint. The Russian dictator, basically waving his fist when his armies aren't doing that well, and leaders of the West speaking about Russia's aggression and the need to support Ukraine. Might be an interesting day.
Ambassador Daniel Freed, thanks very much indeed for joining us here on BBC News.
Well, the obvious thing to point out there, that Putin did none of the things that he suggested. So clearly he doesn't know anything about
that. How does he keep his job when he's such an appalling analyst?
Well, because you keep your job. And don't forget, American ambassadors are not professional diplomats. He is a political appointee, probably somebody who gave an awful lot of money to Obama's election campaign. That's what gives him the qualifications to be an ambassador. And of course, he's also no doubt got, you know, and you know, you don't get to that position by questioning the policy.
Over the next couple of days, I'm going to do my best to put that beautiful, amazing, marvellous, and I promise I didn't make it up, clip of the BBC putting together this little. Maybe it was just providence, you know, amazing coincidence, but of the tank firing into the guy's head as he's speaking, absolutely amazing little bit of serendipity there. But then the big thing he's talking about there, of course, is Putin and his speech on Monday. So let's have a listen to just the sort of tail end of that now. And we'll have a little. We can also hear the kind of a little bit of the music that goes at the end of it. Now, this is very important for the Russians, the Second World War, isn't it? I think, wasn't it the 9th of May that they ceased hostilities?
Well, it was when
1945.
It was when Admiral Dönitz signed the surrender to the Soviet Union, Britain and the United States in Berlin.
It's very significant because various people like Goering wanted to take over from Hitler once he'd committed suicide, supposedly, or was shot by Martin Bormann, but the Brits who were hanging around, who knows? But the significance of Dönitz taking over was that there was certain German equipment in submarines heading to Japan and other parts of the world at the end of the war. So that's why Dönitz was the guy who was in charge, the admiral. The end game of the Second World War, we could talk forever about that, Martin, but is there anything you'd like to say about the deals done with the Brits and the Americans?
In 1945 or now? It's remembered in Russia and has been remembered and the Soviet Union before that as a very important day for obvious reasons. It's the biggest military struggle in the country's history, if not, and probably the biggest military struggle on the planet to date.
I mean, one of the things Stalin...
No, there's never been a bigger fight than that.
Stalin was moaning at the Brits, wasn't he? And moaning at the Americans. Having started Barbarossa in 1941, so this fight starts over in Eastern Europe. Lots of the German divisions go from the Channel ports, etc., over to fight over there. And that struggle went on and on and on. And it was still 1942, 1943, Stalin's saying, well, why aren't you... doing something about the Western Front. We've been fighting, slogging away with Hitler for years, and why aren't you joining the fight on the Western side?
Well, I mean, we could go through the history of the Second World War.
What I'm coming to talk about is Dieppe, because the Dieppe raid was the Brits' way of saying, oh, well, we did try. 1942, wasn't it, with a whole load of Canadians, and they got thrown back. But as we know, through John Ainsworth Davis, he was sent over to tell the Nazis that this raid was coming. And so it was doomed to fail. He was stood up on the cliffs as these Canadian soldiers came charging in, trying to prove that they were going to try and get a foothold on the continent to please Stalin. Then suddenly all these Germans were sitting there, and they of course the raid failed. So they sent a message to Stalin saying, well, we did our best, but of course they didn't do their best. They wanted Stalin to slog it out for them.
That's right, and they were prepared to supply the Soviet Union with lend-lease, you know, because they're doing the fighting, so we might as well give them some weaponry. But of course at the same time, big American companies were still supplying weaponry to the Germans. And of course, from people like Churchill's point of view, the Russians and the Germans knocking hell out of each other is fine, especially if we can keep out of it until and then we move in at the end, which is exactly what happened.
And of course, it's a sort of succession of things over the centuries where the Western Europe has had launched various attacks against the Russians, and maybe another one to come, who knows, with Napoleon, etc. But I went to the National Museum in Moscow, the Great Patriotic War Museum, which was quite a fascinating. Spent a day there with the missus and had a lovely lunch, which was out of a billy can, which is sort of military Russian military soup and a bit of bread in a tent, which was made up to look like it was a sort of field tent. And the most striking thing about it was most probably the ruins of the giant Nazi eagle from the centre of Berlin, which was smashed in several pieces. That was there in the museum, as was the most massive chest. It was a transparent perspex chest running right the way down the main entrance hall of tens of thousands of iron crosses, Martin, that they collected in that battle, in those battles. I mean, obviously, there was something like 30, 35 million Russians died in the Second World War, as against our, I think, was roughly 250,000 Brits.
Yeah. And of course, the Russians get very upset about this because they feel as if their sacrifice has been downgraded and misunderstood and all the rest of it. On that front, I watched this film originally in the 1980s when it came out, and you can find it on YouTube. It's called Come and See, and it's about the Eastern Front. It's a war film, it's a fictional war film, and it's about Belarus, where the Germans carried out a campaign of massacre. And it's one of the most violent war films I've ever watched. And it's very artistic.
Is it instructive?
It's very artistic and it's very violent. And if you want to understand the psychology of Russians about World War II, it's a great film to watch.
Yeah, they don't dismiss this idea that the Nazis survived the Second World War and re-manifested.
Well, because they
particularly
did.
Because
especially in the Ukraine. Yeah. I mean, Stepan Bandera, who was allied with Adolf Hitler, escaped to the West, and he wasn't punished. He was actually helped to create sort of stay-behind units in the Ukraine, and he was eventually assassinated by the KGB in Munich in 1959.
And so he'd been freely moving around in the West.
That's right. Well, basically, the Ukrainian People's Army, which had fought for the Nazis, were basically spirited. I mean, when they made it to the West, a lot of them went to Canada. And far from being punished, these people were integrated into NATO's intelligence structure at that stage. Yeah, and you can be quite sure that the FSB are very well aware of this history.
They certainly are. Of course they are. And of course, this week was all about history over in Moscow, where this is the tail end of Vladimir Putin's speech in Red Square.
Public organizations will do everything to help those families, to provide special assistance to children of those who were wounded or who lost their lives. And I signed a decree about this. I wish a speedy recovery to those who were wounded. I want to thank medical staff in working in hospitals for their hard work, and those who are trying to save every single life without sparing theirs. Dear comrades, today, here and now, in the Red Square, shoulder to shoulder, soldiers and officers are standing from many different regions of our country, including those who came right from Donbass, directly from the war zone. We remember how the enemies of Russia were trying to use the gangs of international terrorists, trying to put the seeds of religious hatred. They didn't succeed. Today, the fighters of different nationalities are fighting together, covering each other from the shrapnels. And that shows that we are united. Today you are defending what your fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers were fighting for, who saw security of their country as their priority. This is the biggest value that Russia relies on. Those who fought Nazis showed us their bravery. This was the generation of victorious troops. Glory to our armed forces. Hooray to Russia.
There's the end of the speech in Red Square, Martin. I mean, he's really saying that this is a kind of continuation of the Second World War, he thinks, and there are other commentators saying that too.
That's true. And, of course, in the West, they're also trying to say, Zelensky was saying that this is a continuation of the Second World War and we're the anti-fascists, which is absurd. Just absurd. And I'm not saying Zelensky is a fascist,
Goebbels,
because he's not.
Was it Goebbels that said the best thing to do in propaganda is accuse the other side of what you're doing?
Well, I think that's right. It's projection. People do it in personal rows and relationships, never mind in international politics. I'm astonished how completely misinformed the political elite in the West are about how this crisis has come about. And of course, if those like the former ambassador have got such a limited view of what's underlying all of this, it's not surprising that the ordinary punters don't have a clue.
Well, we had
and at the same time that all of them seem to think that they know what's happening here, when in actual fact, if you just ask some basic questions, it's quite obvious that they don't.
So we heard a bit from Chris Busby, Dr. Chris Busby, earlier on, talking about these mini reactors. It's a terrific interview with him, talking about his new paper about the failure of the risk model for nuclear power stations, and just generally around nuclear facilities. going into great detail about how internal radiation is not being counted, where actually that's the biggest killer. He also talks about the atmospheric tests in the 1950s having a massive, massive effect on increasing cancers right across the planet, which is completely taboo in the industry. And he's doing very well nowadays. He actually says something quite positive, which is that there seems to be scientists around the world taking his work much more seriously since it's been in these peer-reviewed papers, because it's very difficult to criticise. It's all fully referenced, and he's done a lot of experiments to back up what he says. And of course, there's a lot of money behind the industry. So, but some people somewhere, publishers, for example, are actually encouraging people to criticise the industry because they can see where the figures of radiation and cancers are leading. Anyway, Chris is living over in Latvia now, so I thought I'd better ask him about how long he thinks the Ukraine war is going to last.
I think it's going to last certainly a few months. It might be over after that. I don't think it's going to last for the rest of the year. It's going to in my opinion, it's going to result in a sort of North Korea, South Korea situation where there's some kind of border. My concern is Poland, I have to say. I think there's something going on in Poland and Lithuania which might change the whole direction of the argument. The Poles used to own the Ukraine, you see. It used to be, I mean, if you go right back to the time of the Bolsheviks, when Ukraine suddenly started, I mean, before that, it was just a lot of different people. But if you read The White Guard by Bulgakov, he writes very accurately and at the time about what was happening in the Ukraine at that point. And the Poles and the Lithuanians, they owned that part of Western Ukraine, and I think they want to get it back. So the Polish people are making all sorts of noises about brotherhood and friendship with Western Ukraine. So it could be that there will be an Eastern Ukraine, which is Russian-speaking, and a Western Ukraine, which is Ukrainian and Polish-speaking, as a sort of result of all of this stuff. God only knows about the nuclear aspect. That does worry me. I mean, if Sweden and Finland become members of NATO, they will be flying these American bombers that can carry this B-31 nuclear bomb, and then of course Putin will have to bring a load of missiles to the border, and so we will be a border country. What will happen here is that we'll become very rich, because everyone will come here and we'll be like frontline states, and all the prices of everything will go up, etc., etc., etc. I mean, I tell you what worries me, Tony, is that all of my life I've tried to run away from this stuff, and wherever I go, it follows me. You wouldn't have thought that I'd come all the way to Latvia and go and live in a forest, and suddenly Latvia is the front line against the Russian nuclear weapons.
Dr. Chris Busby there, now over in Latvia, bless him. Brilliant new paper, and I'll circulate that as a PDF if anyone's interested, along with the message I send out every Sunday evening, early Monday morning, with a sort of summary of what's been in the show with links, etc. And so I'll make sure that his paper is included in that as an attachment to the emails. If you want to get on that list, just email me, tony@cultureshop.org.uk. All the info is there at thisweek.org.uk. But he's saying quite a lot there, Martin, isn't he, about, I mean, for example, fascinating about Poland. Do you think Poland has got territorial aims, potentially?
The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was really in the 17th century, so it's quite a long time ago. But yes, they used to control that whole region and everything of what we now think of as the Ukraine. And so historically, Ukraine was dominated by Poland. And then subsequently, when Poland was dismembered in the 18th century, the Western Ukraine was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Meanwhile, the Donbass has been Russian-speaking since the 19th century, because it was one of the first places in Russia which was industrialised, and lots of Russian speakers moved there at that time.
And it was called the heart of Russia, actually, the Donbass. And I've got a fantastic poster. I think I saw it on a tweet, which was 1930s, I think, or maybe 40s Russian poster, which talks about the Donbass as being the heart of Russia. It's all in Russian Cyrillic script, but it's a great old style Soviet poster. This is very much, you know, this is, I suppose, one of the reasons why the Russians have felt that so strongly that they want to look after this region, because it is their industrial heartland.
Well, it was back in the 19th century, and also under the Soviet, you know, the early industrializations plans of the 5-year plans of the Soviet Union. And it's still important, but it's less important in the modern world because Russia has developed all sorts of industries elsewhere.
Well, what do you think about what Chris is saying there about this sort of North-South Korea thing, the idea that it might just be divided?
I think it's pretty clear what's going to happen is there will be, that's where we were after.
East-West.
Yeah, I think what the Russians are going to do, they've now completely surrounded the Ukrainian army, but the Ukrainian army is sitting on the areas which actually voted to secede from the Ukraine in 2014. Okay? So they're an occupying force. Many of the people in the Ukrainian army are conscripts. The ones that aren't conscripts are basically, you know, Azov battalion. They're big. They're not just a battalion. There's tens of thousands of them. And they are extremist anti-Russian military force. None of them are locals, or very few of them, and the locals don't want them there.
Well, there was a marvellous ITV report from James Mates back in 2014 showing the people of Mariupol jeering the Ukrainian army when they went in to take over the police station in Mariupol from the separatists.
Well, what happened when the coup took place in the Maidan, the Maidan coup, which of course was precipitated by a NATO death squad shooting both police officers and pro-EU demonstrators, and a new regime was put in without an election.
And a Masonic lodge, by the way, with Viktor Pinchuk at the top of it, and Yatsenyuk.
Yes, sorry, but these NATO networks in the Ukraine go back to the 1940s, yeah?
So what happened in Mariupol police station in 2014? Because it's great to see this old ITV report. It's almost like they've forgotten it ever happened. I'll put a link up to it on our show page, thisweek.org.uk.
Obviously, people in the Crimea were very unhappy with the coup, and they almost immediately said, because they'd voted several times to leave the Ukraine. They'd never been wanted to part of the Ukraine, but nobody would listen to them.
It's amazing to see all these local citizens jeering these soldiers taking over their police station.
That's because in the two oblasts of Donetsk and Luhansk, the local people organized, a referendum to secede from the Ukraine. And the reason they did that is partly because of the nature of the coup in Kiev, and also because of the massacre in Odessa, which was carried out by football hooligans from Kiev Dynamo, who eventually became the Azov Battalion, and the police did nothing as all these people were burned to death who were anti the coup. And at that point, these regions voted to leave the Ukraine, and then they were attacked.
So are we going to have
didn't attack, they were themselves attacked, and then they defended themselves.
Are we going to see a partition east-west Ukraine?
Of course, that's clearly what's going to happen. The question is, where is it going to be? Mm. Now, what may happen, I think what the Russians are going to do, if you want me to give me my opinion, I'll give you my opinion. Donetsk and Luhansk are going to be independent republics. They're probably going to vote on whether they want to join the Russian Federation. But there are other parts of the South Ukraine which are largely Russian-speaking, including Odessa, who didn't get a chance to secede in 2014, and I think the Russians will try.
If the Russians try and take Odessa, there's going to be a far worse fight than Mariupol.
Yeah, but they may not try. As you can see, they haven't tried to take Odessa. What they will do is surround it, as they've done with Kharkov. The reason they took Mariupol is because that's where the Azov Battalion were, which is the hardcore Nazis, and also Mariupol was the headquarters of the NATO intelligence and military who were going to coordinate the attack on the Donbass. And, of course, by the Russians going in, what they could have done is waited for the attack to go ahead, then counterattacked, which would have looked much better in terms of Western public opinion. But because they knew the attack was going ahead, by preempting the attack in the way they did, they've captured all of the documents and the personnel that were behind the attack on the Donbass.
Plus, they've been around those bio labs too, haven't they?
That's right.
Which is fascinating. Anyway, we're going to look at the economic war now. The end of the petrodollar. This is a fascinating chat between Catherine Austin Fitz this week and Carol von Wolferen. It's called Reset in Ukraine Part 2. And here's a little extract where Carol von Wolferen, he is a Dutch guy, talks about this old economic warfare and how he believes that Putin has won spectacularly.
Gradually, Putin managed to organize the oligarchs. It's a long story, a very interesting story. Some could remain and others were sort of in exile or self-imposed exile.
Mm-hmm.
And he did so very well. It was when I saw that happening, I thought this is a statesman of a caliber that we haven't seen anywhere. This is so well done. I mean, this is Bismarck. This is then, of course, we always got this opposition. It never disappeared. There was always a fifth column. There were always NGOs were allowed to operate in Moscow with the specific purpose of undermining the Russian Federation.
He finally kicked
it
them
never,
out.
And he finally got rid of them. As a result of this, of the sanctions were the means, the sanctions placed upon Russia were the means for Putin to respond in a way that the West was not prepared for. And of course, it was a masterstroke. The fact that they had left Russian assets in Western banks was a trap. You hear some critics saying it was Elvira Nebolinia, the governor of the Russian Central Bank, who comes out of this nest of neoliberal reformers. But it was a mistake by her. No. Well, this was a trap. And the U.S. jumped right into this trap, making clear to all and sundry that your savings are not safe in Western banks if you do something that the U.S. doesn't like, because it will freeze your assets.
So the U.S. has done this before. Russia's not the first.
No.
Russia's just the first.
No. Venezuela right. Got its asset by the Brits. And Venezuela, it's a small place. It was the Brits. This wasn't the same thing.
Right.
And there were maybe other things. But this is so big. I mean, the Russian assets is not nothing. It was so big that this was momentous. And what it has meant is that it's the end of the petrodollar. Finished.
But let me just say, because it's getting more complicated. They froze the Russian assets and the central banking assets.
Yeah.
But what they've also done, the first payment by the Russians, so the United States debt is approximately 140% of their GDP. Russia's debt is approximately 18%.
Yes, practically right. Nothing.
So Russia does not, you know, the Anglo-American alliance always put people in a debt trap, and they can't put Russia
right.
in a debt trap.
Right.
That's part of the lesson Russia learned after right. the 90s.
That's right.
So on the first debt payment, the Russians, I think it was Citibank, agreed to process the payment, and the payment got made. Now the Western banks are refusing to process the payment. So even though the Russians can't use their money sitting in the bank accounts in the Western banks, the Western banks refuse to process their payment to pay the debt. And they're trying to take the position that the Russians are defaulting on their debt. In my world, this is called a contrived default.
Yes.
Because they're not letting you pay the debt service, and then they're saying you defaulted.
It doesn't concern Putin. I mean, he's way above it. What he has done has had far greater impact. He's brought gold back. And that means that other countries too are thinking.
I'm going to stop you there because Putin started in 2005 to bring the gold back. So he's been accumulating gold and moving to this. And we've watched the global rebalancing of the gold inventory since then. So this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, but he's bringing the gold back as support of the ruble.
No. He's brought it back in support of the ruble domestically, not internationally. What he also did is he set up an office. The Central Bank of Russia set up an office many years ago in China so they could transact gold. So he's got gold transacting with the Chinese through Beijing, through Moscow, Beijing, direct linkage. And he's got it as a set domestically, but it's not a gold standard globally.
Okay. A very important bit of news that you must have seen, I think, is that when this was developing in the early stages of its development, since Putin's measures, it was Biden, or at least somebody on behalf of Biden, who called the Saudis. The Saudis were the origin right. of the petrodollar.
Right, right.
No answer. Mm-hmm. It's the first time
right.
that the Saudis haven't responded, or haven't answered a call from the American president.
So, and I was
so what does it mean? That the Saudis and China have made a deal?
Mm-hmm.
India and China have made a deal? The Saudis, and they're all making deals.
Right.
And it's not with petrodollars.
Right.
It's right. with gold and their own currency.
Right.
And they are developing, or they're trying to develop, they have to still, from what I understand, they still have to find a real formula for a substitute of a reserve currency. And the Chinese and the Russians are working on that together.
Well, if I was Director General of the BBC, I'd give Catherine Austin Fitz a weekly programme. She seems to find some fascinating people. She's also a brilliant interviewer. And what a fascinating take on all of this, Martin, that was. What do you make of what he's saying, though, there? The crux of it is that actually the Russians have calculated they're going to lose X amount of money because those assets have been frozen, but what they gain is the end of the petrodollar, and it's worth it. It's worth that money for finishing off the American domination of international finance.
I think they war-gamed all of this before they did what they did. So they, it's not as if they're surprised by any of the moves that the West has taken, but they've calculated how to deal with it. Sergei Glazyev, who was recommended to me as somebody who knew what he was talking about in 1993, is now working. His job is to work with the Chinese to develop the world alternative currency to the dollar. And it isn't just gold. Gold will be part of the mix, but it's also going to be bringing together commodities, various commodities. So basically commodity money is being brought back by the Chinese and the Russians after it was abolished by Nixon in 1971. They're going to bring it back. And ultimately, of course, this means the end of the derivatives-based Western financial system. They were hoping to crash the Russian banking system, and by doing what they're doing, they're going to crash the Western banking system, but the Chinese and the Russian banking system, and the Chinese banking system, of course, is owned by the government, is going to survive, and that will be devastating for Western power. And they will basically lose everything because they bet the farm.
So that's Carol von Wolfram with Catherine Austin Fitz. I'll put a link to the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Also, Robert Hansen, I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. Didn't get a chance last week, but this week let's have a listen to him talking about, as we move away from looking at Ukraine, the 20,000 are leaving Hong Kong a week, Martin, due to the vaccine pass restrictions.
You couldn't enter any government building. You couldn't enter shopping malls. You couldn't enter supermarkets. You couldn't go to bars and restaurants. It really stopped you from doing many, many, many things. And yes, you could still do that. There's a fear that would stop, but that hasn't stopped. And another scary thing they're doing is they're force testing people. So they're still locking down about 40 apartment blocks every single day and force testing people. That's ramming something up their nose and down their throat. And if you're found positive, this is the really bad bit. They ship you off to a quarantine camp and you could be stuck there for 21 days and tested every day. Now, a number of people have committed suicide in those places or gone completely cuckoo crazy. And I think yesterday, a very famous actor called Kenneth Jung died in one of those quarantine hotels. He's played in one of the James Bond movies, Die Another Day, and he's a very famous actor in Hong Kong and China. And he was in a quarantine hotel and he died, I think it was yesterday or the day before. This is the crazy. It's totally upside down logic. I think it's a little like the Stanford experiments, if you remember those, where Stanford University, they had pretend guards and pretend prisoners. And once people become a bit power crazy, they become absolute power crazy. And that's the most frightening thing about Hong Kong and China at the moment, the way COVID has allowed them to treat people and just lock them away like animals. You know, people in these quarantine centres have killed themselves. They've gone cuckoo crazy. Healthy people have gone in there and then kept testing positive for COVID and been trapped in there. Healthy people have gone in there and then got food poisoning or got other diseases. So that's completely mad. And they can just roll up at your house anytime, your apartment block, and force test you and just throw you in one of those places whenever they want. So, you know, people are being treated like cattle, and that's not a good thing.
That's Robert Hansen, and I'll put a longer version, the long version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Plus, I think I'll make a do a YouTube of that, because it's fascinating to hear about why all these people are flooding out of Hong Kong with your wonderful Chinese rule, Martin, that you seem to so support with their lockdowns.
Well, 20,000 people a day in Hong Kong.
A week, sorry.
Well, where are they going?
A lot coming here, but anywhere, indeed. Just getting out of Dodge, because they're not going to have these.
Well, it's interesting
measures.
Is that they've got the right to come here. They just walk in because they've been promised that they could come to this country. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been in refugee camps with no status whatsoever for 50 years.
You're just dodging the question, aren't you? Yes,
I'm
you
asking
are.
The question, why did they come? If they didn't
because
have anywhere to go, they
it's a former British
leave.
Colony, and the British government
so
is responsible.
Palestine. Yeah, anyway,
well, yes,
anyway,
it's a lot longer ago.
No,
but anyway, the
long.
Point being, look, I mean, there are some reasons, I think, possibly get outs for the Chinese government as to why they're doing these very strict measures over there, including the lockdowns. One of them is that they just don't want to trade with the West, and it's a good excuse to shut the port of Shanghai down.
Well, after many weeks of being what I regard as talking more sensible geopolitics, we're back to the politics of lockdowns. I believe that, and of course this is coming out of the Russian discovery of the biolabs in the Ukraine, and the Chinese are very interested in this, is that COVID-19 is a biological weapon created by the West,
so
initially
think,
to try and attack
the
Chinese.
Question? I mean, we've heard you saying that week after week. Can you answer the question about maybe the Chinese are looking at these lockdowns as, you know, potentially a world war coming? Wouldn't it be quite a good idea to lock a city down and prepare people for real biological warfare? Also, to shut Shanghai down so that they can have a covert trade war with America and the West, so they can say, well, we're very sorry, we can't send you anything, but it's not a trade war.
Well, I think that the decision to lock down Shanghai won't be based on the idea that we're going to have a covert trade war. There's going to be an overt trade war. It doesn't need to be covert at all. I think they are definitely treating it as we are preparing to go to war with the Western deep state. And our population had better understand that this is what it may imply, is that we're going to, when we say jump, you jump, because
well,
we're going
seem,
to war
it
here.
It does seem to me that the Chinese and the Russians are taking preparations for a world war far more seriously than the West is.
Well, that's right, because they're the intended victims of it, and they've been watching this. What's happened in the past is that the Russians have been saying to the Chinese, you can't trust the West.
We had a big
you
switch.
You can't trust them.
Back in
you
the
can't
1990s.
Trust them. The Chinese were saying, well, they'll come round. And the Chinese said, no, they won't. You're going to have to fight with them.
We had a big switch in this country back in the 1990s from what was called the Civil Defence Act to something called the Civil Contingencies Act, which completely, basically, abrogated the responsibility of central government and regional and local government to look after people in the case of some sort of war. In other words, make sure people were fed, etc. So I just don't think they really, you know, maybe care that much about us at all. Anyway, one of the main things I wanted to look at this week, we're going to move on now to look at a couple of things other than Ukraine, which is Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Martin. Unbelievable things happening. And there's this explosion in Cuba too. We're going to hear about that right now.
An explosion at a luxury hotel in the Cuban capital Havana has killed at least 18 people. The blast tore through several floors of the Hotel Saratoga. The Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, said that the explosion had resulted from what he called a gas accident, though investigations are still underway. More than 60 people were injured. Our Latin America correspondent, Will Grant, is following developments from...
I won't play the rest of that report because he doesn't really add much. But, I mean, is it possible that we've got terrorism going on here, regime change in Pakistan and Sri Lanka?
In Pakistan and Sri Lanka, I think we can talk about regime change. But in Cuba, this particular incident may be a terrorist attack
the point
on the Cubans,
is, look,
or it may
look,
not.
The point is that all these countries voted at the UN against the idea of sanctions on Russia.
Yes, and it's quite clear. I mean, Imran Khan, who's been removed as the Prime Minister of Pakistan, is pretty clear that he thinks he's been removed by the Americans because of his stance. So there it is.
Well, I think he has. I mean,
yeah, well, I think it's pretty obvious, yes. And of course, the other thing, in Sri Lanka, Rajapaksa, I think his name is, had to resign. There is going to
had his house burnt down.
Yes, I know, but that's he's the guy that was in charge of suppressing the LTTE. So he's, you know, it's not the sort of thing he's going to intimidate.
This is order from chaos, isn't it? Yeah. This is disaster capitalism, where you can create an absolute disaster and then try and control the outcome.
Well, if people look at Michael Hudson's recent stuff, he's just got a new book out, which is The Future of Civilization. Finance capitalism, industrial capitalism, and socialism. It's just come out, and I was reading an interview with him yesterday. It's really good. But what's going to happen now over the summer, Sri Lanka is the first domino to fall, but loads of developing countries are going to default on their debts, which is then going to lead to a massive banking crisis and huge social upheaval across the planet.
Anyway, as promised last week, we're going to look at the P2 scandal. Of course, it's Friday the 13th. Today, Friday the 13th of May, happens usually about once a year on this programme. It's lovely to do something about the Friday the 13th, because I think there's an immense amount to be learned by understanding how good Friday the 13th and the number 13 are, with the arrest of the Templars back in 1307, something which I actually went down to St Mary Redcliffe Church here in Bristol a few years ago and witnessed the first public initiation of a Knights Templar in St Mary Redcliffe, right here in Bristol, since the 1300s. And these arrests. But anyway, Martin Short takes us through this in a documentary that he did back in the 1980s for Granada Television and ITV about the P2 scandal from his Inside the Brotherhood three-part TV documentary.
A police raid on the properties of an obscure mattress manufacturer in Arezzo, Tuscany. His name was Licio Gelli. The police seized thousands of documents relating to a Masonic lodge called P2, which almost no one outside Freemasonry knew anything about. What shocked the police were the names on a list of 980 members. There were dozens of leading Italian businessmen and industrialists, and the police chiefs of Italy's four biggest cities, a total of 43 MPs, including the Ministers of Justice and Foreign Trade. There were 51 generals and admirals, and the heads of all Italy's secret services. Together, these men operated like a private government, manipulating one of Europe's biggest democracies. Leading bankers like Calvi completed the list.
When the Italian government gave out publicly the list of the P2, we were astonished. It was like discovering that Italian democracy was something else from what we had always believed. We saw that there was another something going on underneath the surface of events. And so we ask ourselves why.
The answer goes back to a bitter struggle between Freemasons and the Catholic Church in Italy, which has lasted ever since English gentlemen and sea captains introduced the Brotherhood here in the 1730s. The Church soon branded Freemasonry the work of the devil and excommunicated all Catholic Masons. Italian Freemasonry turned anti-Catholic and revolutionary and went underground. It has had a clandestine and persecuted history ever since. The Grand Orient is Italian Freemasonry's ruling body.
Contrary to what happens in England and America, where the state not only tolerates Freemasonry, but recognizes it, here state and church don't recognize it, but even condemn it without knowing it.
In 1926, Italy's dictator Mussolini banned Freemasonry. After World War II, it was made legal again, and an old secret elite lodge was reborn as Propaganda Due, or P2. This failed to recruit many members, until the Grand Master at the time asked Licio Gelli to take over in 1970. Gelli immediately set about changing the character of P2. Tonight, he speaks out in defense of his lodge.
Inside the P2 lodge, we had the top men Italy had in all fields, in the world of politics, in diplomacy, the top men from industry, the press, the law, and the civil service. They were all the very best.
fatto che cercavano e volevano avere.
By joining P2, they wanted peace and tranquility within the lodge, so that they could all contribute in their own fields to the betterment of society.
L'uno sia l'altro per poter migliorare la società.
Jelly initiated his P2 elite in a suite in Rome's Excelsior Hotel, not in a Masonic temple. It never met like a conventional lodge. Instead, select groups of members plotted to control the state, as agendas seized at Jelly's premises revealed.
The political and economic situation of Italy, the threat of the Italian Communist Party, aiming at the conquest of power, the spread of immorality, indiscipline, relationships with the Italian state.
We were striving for the improvement of society, to make a contribution, to safeguard the democratic institutions of our country. This was P2.
But in the 1930s and 40s, when Mussolini ruled Italy, Jelly was a dedicated fascist, and he's never been a friend of democracy. After the war, he fled to South America. He returned in the 1960s, when he was wealthy, respectable, and an ideal Masonic recruit.
I felt Masonry was the university where one went to learn rules of right and wrong and graduated with a degree in morals, sound principles, and ethics. These were the only reasons I joined the Masons, and I'd join them again. I have been a Mason, I am a Mason, and I shall behave all my life as a Mason.
He's a man that likes darkness. He's a man that likes intrigue. He's a man that says that likes democracy, but has a very strange idea of democracy. He comes from the extreme right. I don't think he has ever left that position. His friends are still the same fascists that he met with during the war.
After the raid on Jelly's villa and the exposure of P2, it became clear that the main aim of the lodge was to subvert democracy. An exhaustive parliamentary inquiry found that P2 was a state within a state, a cell of extreme right-wingers bent on maintaining power by ruthless means. For example, in 1978, Italy's Christian Democrat Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, favoured bringing the communists into government in a plan known as the Historic Compromise. But then, Moro's car was ambushed and he was kidnapped by left-wing terrorists. Evidence which later emerged suggested that the longer Moro was held captive, the better it suited the P2 Masons who headed the secret services.
Chi avrebbe dovuto trovare Aldo Moro?
A committee drawn up from the staff of the Interior Ministry was put in charge of finding Moro. They were nearly all P2 men. Later, I was on the Moro inquiry. I read all the documents, the few there were from that committee, and I must say, dispassionately, that they had no intention of finding Moro. To leave Moro in the hands of the terrorists, to let the situation rot, was a sure way to make sure that the historic compromise did not come to fruition.
Three months after Moro's kidnap, he was found dead in the boot of a car. His body bore the marks of repeated torture. But Italy's body politic had also been mutilated, and the communists have been shut out of government ever since. According to the Italian Parliament's report, P2 members, in a black propaganda campaign, also planned or backed grotesque acts of terror, including one of Europe's worst terrorist crimes. In 1980, a bomb blew up in Bologna station, killing 85 people. To discredit the communists, this was made to look like an act of left-wing terror, but it was committed by fascists.
The massacre, according to the High Court of Bologna, was committed by some subversive neo-fascist individuals. But it's also a fact that a near-permanent contact was established between right-wing subversive elements, the P2 Lodge, and the men of P2.
Today, under the nervous protection of armed police, Jelly is at liberty in his magnificent home in Tuscany.
While not directly involved in the Bologna bombing, this year he was convicted of covering the bomber's tracks and given a 10-year jail sentence. However, the terms of his earlier extradition from Switzerland mean he will never go to jail for the crime.
So that's Licio Gelli he's talking about, who died a couple of years ago. In fact, we did a special feature when he died about Gelli. Propaganda P2A, they call it, Martin. This is a fascinating scandal, and it sort of reveals, it's almost like taking down the veil of how things really work, for, and this was particularly for the Italian public.
Yeah, and of course what's missing from that is the role of CIA MI6. It wasn't just homegrown Italian fascists doing this. It was NATO intelligence services, as Daniel Ganser, the Swiss academic, wrote in his book NATO's Secret Armies.
In a tactic borrowed from the Nazis, actually. That, yes. What they called the werewolf units in Nazi Germany.
That's right. And, of course, the best film on this, as you know, is the one by Frankovich in the Time Watch series on BBC Two, where he interviewed Gelli and others, are all in the film.
I think this is what Martin Short's done, though. I think he's taken a very good long view of... I mean, this was big in the 1980s. There was lots of people talking about this. The idea is now nobody knows about it. Nobody talks about it. One of the most interesting things about this Propaganda Due Lodge is that I came across some writings about the Illuminati from the 1700s by John Robison, who was the secretary of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and he was a Freemason. He was disgusted to see Freemasonry being taken over by these, what they called illuminated lodges, who were almost sort of hovering above Freemasonry. Just a quote from his book, which is Proofs of a Conspiracy, is the name of the book, Against All Religions and Governments of Europe, carried on in the secret meetings of Freemasons, Illuminati and Reading Societies, collected from good authorities by John Robison, Professor of Natural Philosophy and Secretary to the Royal Society of Edinburgh. Terrific read, actually. It's very well worth reading this. You can get it free. I think it's on sacredtext.com. But anyway, quoting from that, in the Hamburg, he's really revealing some of the original plans of this Illuminati takeover of Freemasonry back in the 1790s. He says, in the Hamburg Political Journal, August, September and October in 1790, there are many proofs of the machinations of emissaries from the Mason lodges of Paris amongst the German Freemasons. So he's looking at the connections between the Germans and the French Revolution. It appears that a club has taken the name of Propaganda and meets once a week at least in the form of a Mason lodge. It consists of persons of all nations and is under the direction of the Grand Master, the Duke of Orleans. De Luther is one of the wardens. They've divided Europe into colonies to which they have given revolutionary names such as the cap, the pike, the lantern, etc. They have ministers in these colonies. One is pointed out in Saxony by Marx, which I presume are well understood. A secret press is founded in Saxe-Gotha, furnished with German types, which printed a seditious work called the Journal of Humanity. This journal was found in the mornings, lying in the streets and highways. The house belongs to an Illuminatus of the name of Duport, a poor schoolmaster. He was associated with another in Strasbourg, who was also an Illuminatus, his name being Mayer, the writer of the Strasbourg newspaper. He had been sometime a teacher in Saltzman's Academy, and we see he was also an Illuminatus, but displeased with their proceedings almost at the first. So the point really here is that here is the evidence from the 1790s that this secret society taking over Freemasonry was setting up these propaganda lodges. And there it is, back in 1980, actually being revealed. I think that's fascinating, Martin.
Well, as you pointed out, Gelli was a fascist in the 1930s and 40s, and Mussolini suppressed the Freemasons. So at that stage, Gelli wasn't a Freemason. And then he subsequently became one, because Propaganda Due in Italy, from the 1960s onwards, I would say, was actually orchestrated by the NATO intelligence services to, they've got to get all these people together behind the scenes in some form or other, and they chose Freemasonry as that form. But I don't think it's actually to do with Freemasonry. It's to do with fascism and intelligence services.
Well, yes, and of course, quite famously, we had Jack Lopresti on this programme when we were on FM, who's a Freemason and an MP, and he said, well, Hitler persecuted the Freemasons. Well, I mean, one cult, the SS, doesn't want it to have any rival cults around, does it?
Well, that's right. And so, therefore, Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations says men of business never get together even on a social occasion without some conspiracy against the public being discussed. The ruling classes use things like the Bullingdon Club, the Freemasons, all of these things, the Royal International Services Institute. These are all mechanisms for achieving elite consensus behind the scenes. Freemasonry definitely plays a role, but of course, back in the 18th century, Freemasonry was associated with the ideals of the French Revolution. It was a bourgeois, rebellion against the feudal order. So people like Mozart and Beethoven were very sympathetic to Freemasonry. But of course, it became a vehicle for prevention of changes in society. It started off as a radical movement,
right,
and eventually just became, well, you know, we're the establishment, and we're trying to stop anybody else doing anything.
Freemasonry was originally a speakeasy. You know, you and I would probably been Masons back in, say, in the 17th century or something.
It was the 18th century.
Well, there was secret Freemasonry going on actually in the 17th century. Ashmole was.
The point being
that it was a way to not be persecuted for your views. You joined the Freemasons. But what John Robison is saying in his book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, is that although these lodges had started with good intentions, that they were being basically hijacked by these particular German Masons. Anyway, the point is that what has Freemasonry got to do with what we're talking about now? Well, Pastor Mike Hoggards from the US has got quite an interesting theory that actually Freemasonry has got a lot to do with the transhumanism that we're grappling with today, this kind of modern version of fascism and social Darwinism.
Masonry is all about rebuilding Solomon's temple. Now remember, the Bible says that the temple is what? The body. So Masonry then secretly is about rebuilding the human being. Now, has anybody ever seen this symbol before? This is on the Masonic temple in McAllister, Oklahoma. A pastor took me there and he said, Pastor Mike, you got to see this stuff. It's a cross with a rose on it. Okay? It is called the Rosicrucian concept or the Rosicrucian doctrine. The Rosicrucians was a secret society that sort of arose in Europe just prior to the time that Masonry was really taking root, and Masonry adopted Rosicrucian thought into its teachings. So Masonry and Rosicrucianism are linked together. Here's what Rosicrucian doctrine says. It says, the manner and the means by which the present day man is transformed into the divine Superman, the Superman race, the divine race. This symbol, Christian Rose Cross, shows the end and aim. And you thought it was just that we came from monkeys. Evolution is not about where we came from, but where they say we're going.
So that's what's his name? Mike Hoggards. He's saying there actually that Freemasonry is tied up with this whole idea of the man god, you know, but actually not just transforming the physical temple of Solomon, but actually transforming the human body. That's what he's saying.
Well, the Freemasons historically tended to be Unitarians. In other words, they believed in God, but they didn't believe in
the Bible. They were deists.
Yes, they were deists. And you know, so Pierre Bezukhov in War and Peace, he became a Freemason as part in the story because of his liberal values and rebellion against, you know, the more oppressive aspects of the society he lived in. These historical, there's too much emphasis upon ideology in my mind. In actual fact, Masonry is a very varied phenomenon, like most religious phenomena.
It was massively influential on the Enlightenment, for example.
Yes, it was. The reason why Freemasonry, and it wasn't just Freemasonry, before Marx came along, it was actually traditional on the left to have secret societies. the Tolpuddle Martyrs were in a secret society.
Right. These societies were there because...
The Carbonari...
Because it was very difficult to actually organise and change anything because society was so strict.
Well, yes, exactly. And also, it's got to be secret because you're going to be oppressed. And the same thing with the Russian Communist Party, or the Social Democratic Party of Russia, as it was then called. They had to be organised on a secret basis because the state was basically oppressive.
One interesting
and
thing
if you
about...
if you weren't secret about things, they were going to lock you up and kill you.
Well, an interesting thing about the Russian Orthodox Church is they still have this thing called the oath crime. Well, of course, it's not in Russian law or whatever, but the Orthodox Church have it, where if you swear an oath... it's basically taken from the Sermon on the Mount in the Bible. In the New Testament, it says, where Jesus says, never swear an oath, simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything else comes from the devil. And I remember putting this to the Grand Master here in Bristol at one of the open days in the Bristol Masonic Hall, which is really two Masonic halls, a Royal Arch Temple and a Craft Masonry Temple. And he then said to me, well, yes, but have you read it in the original Hebrew? And I said, well, actually, no, the original is Greek in the New Testament. And then he sort of had a go at me about putting my hand into a nest of vipers. But anyway, we're going to wind up this week with Mike Mandel. Next week, we're going to have a little, there's a couple of other things I wanted to look at, which is the fake Bill Cooper by the name of Alex Jones and the fake Ivan Fraser by the name of David Icke. But we'll finish this week with the looking at the links between Freemasonry and witchcraft put together by Mike Mandel of Jeremiah Films. And so we'll say goodbye to you now, Martin, and I'll just do my little announcement when we've heard this final clip.
I spoke with a number of former Masons and compared their Blue Lodge initiations with the experiences of former occultists.
In the initiation in Freemasonry, we had to be recommended by another Mason.
Well, in order to join witchcraft, you have to be recommended by somebody currently in witchcraft.
Well, when I was initiated, I was blindfolded and bound by rope, and on your bare chest was thrust the point of a spear.
In witchcraft, we were initiated. The candidate was led blindfolded, bound by a rope, to the edge of the magic circle.
And the rope is around your neck and your lid forward. And up front, in the eastern end of the building, is a person who's a worshipful master. And you kneel down before him as if he were a god.
You are met by the high priest or high priestess with a sword to your chest.
When I went to enter the lodge, a sharp object was put to my left breast. And I was warned that should I reveal any of the secrets of Freemasonry, to know what to expect.
When you're presented before the high priest, a sword is held against your chest, and you actually take a blood oath, promising to remain faithful to the secrets of witchcraft.
Well, when you are in the room, this blindfold is taken away from you, and this is a time when they say that you're coming from darkness into light.
During the initiation ceremony, the initiate is led by the lieutenant of the high priest, and is challenged at the edge of the circle by someone saying, "Who goes there?" And the answer is, "One from the world of darkness."
In Masonry, the prayers are ended with, "So mote it be."
We would always end any spell or ritual where we released the power, this is where the power was released, with the word, "So mote it be."
Some of the parallels between Freemasonry and witchcraft show such a similarity that it cannot possibly be coincidental. Similarities in ritual, wording, and symbolism are so close in several instances that it clearly suggests a common origin.
So that's Mike Mandel there speaking on the Jeremiah Films, which is, I think, fascinating, looking at the, basically, the Freemasons, you know, according to him, anyway, are just witches. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also Labour councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles. Of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, all via thisweekoneword.org.uk, where you can download the longer interviews too. My paperbacks about the deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem, that costs £15. Also, my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader, they're all on eBay, and Siege of Heaven ebook, and links to all of them via bilderberg.org. This show's repeated at 11 on Fridays, 11 and 5. All week on the PRSC stream, which is mostly Sputnik Radio, which is English language Russian broadcast, which has been shut off of the internet, but we're streaming it here as a sort of sustaining service, so you can have a listen to that any time during the week. Pretty much when you're dipping in, you'll probably find Sputnik on the stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen show, which we do from time to time. And also, of course, over Sunday lunch and Saturday now too, on Radio on Camberley's RadioQUK.com. Do please make live recordings too. We've been streaming live from the PRSC, People's Republic, in Bristol, and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream. Back to the regular time at 5 o'clock now, every Friday. God bless, and don't let those Illuminati banksters get you down.
The Messiah.
Who loves you, and who do you love?
The Messiah! The Messiah!
Without further ado, it's time to start running!
Stop the feed.
The Messiah on Kickin' Records, and that was Temple of Dreams.